It's time for Twink This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis is taking the week off to be in Davos. Well, well, well. But don't worry, Matthew Ingram joins us along with Stacey Higginbotham, and there is lots to talk about. The future of Google. We'll talk about Android 8.1, Google I.O. We explain Bitcoin and blockchain, the first logical explanation I've ever heard. And we'll talk about how Burger King is doing its bit for net neutrality. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 441, recorded Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. Whopper neutrality. This Week in Google is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twig. And by WordPress. Make WordPress your online home. Plans start at just $4 a month. Go to wordpress.com/twig. to get 15% off your brand new website today. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, which isn't really about Google anymore. But I thought about what it is, and you know what it is? It's about the future. The future, my friends, as it includes Google, Facebook, Twitter, the Internet of Things. That's because we've got the great Stacey Higginbotham on a regular basis. She's the expert on IoT at StaceyOnIoT.com. That's where her newsletter and podcast live. Hello, Stacey.
Hello.
Hello. And
I'm happy to be.
Normally, Jeff Jarvis would be here, but he is in Davos hobnobbing with the president and Rupert Murdoch. That should be fun. There's a room I'd like to be in. And we thought we would get him on if we could from Switzerland, but you know, it's late at night there, and he says there's more interesting conversations. No, he doesn't, but I'm sure there are.
So. I'm sure he's thinking it, and he would be right to be honest.
Yeah, if you're we'll in be Davos, here next week. Why, yeah, you could do this anytime. But the good news is, to fill Jeff's seat today, we've got the great Matthew Ingram from the Columbia Journalism Review. Hello, Matthew. Good to see you.
Reporting for duty. Good to see you, too.
Wearing his Newsgeist shirt, proving that he is a Googler, a Google algorithm. Is that in Arizona? Was that in Arizona this year?
It is, yeah. They have one in Arizona every year, and then there's one that moves around.
In conjunction with the Knight Foundation.
Yeah.
Matthew and Stacey worked together not once, but twice.
We sure did.
At GigaOM and Fortune.
And it was great both times.
And they're refugees from those, and they are here with us today. And Twit makes three, so it is three times. You're right. Come to think of it. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Third time lucky.
There's a lot of, we could talk about, you know, Android 8.1 showing Wi-Fi speeds and YouTube TV having less than 300,000 subscribers and Facebook giving people a chance to rate news organizations, and we'll get to all of that. But I was kind of captivated by Steve Yegi's post this morning on Medium. And I thought that he raised some really interesting issues. Why I left Google to join Grab. He was an engineer at Google, a well-known engineer at Google for 13 years. And he left because he says Google is no longer innovating. They're chasing competitors instead of serving customers. Gatekeeping and risk aversion at Google are the norm rather than the exception.
I think he's got a point.
Yeah.
I think he's got a point. I mean, he put into words, obviously I don't work at Google, but he put into words some of the things that I've thought about things Google is doing. There's a lot more risk aversion. There's a lot more kind of, you know, do the things that are safe and kind of incremental stuff. And we've talked about this before. I miss the old Google where the moonshots and the stuff where they were doing things because they wanted to change something for the better, not just because they wanted to sort of make incremental revenue.
he brings up, you know, all of the kind of failed Google initiatives like Google Plus and Allo and Reader and Hangouts. And you know, I mean, we talk about it sometimes too, but he also says, and I agree with this, I love the people at Google. They're super smart and world-class and always humble individuals. He says, Google, though, has gotten less humble. He says, company strategy is a mess. Googlers, people working there, know this is happening. They're as frustrated by it as you are, but their leadership is failing them, and that's mostly because Google has become 100% competitor-focused rather than customer focus. But I'd say this is the innovator's dilemma anyway. I mean, this is just,
this also strikes me as a very engineering oriented, like, post. As any company, and I was on this side. I mean, I remember showing up at GigaOM one day at our home office, and there were like 80 people there, and I was like, what the heck happened?
Who are all these people?
And even then, I had very similar complaints. I'm like, oh, we don't focus on the important stuff. Everyone wants us to focus on this other stuff. And part of that is, it's moving from being a company that has created something really amazing to being a company that shelters and protects what they've created that was amazing and then tries to continue building.
And this is inevitable. Again, the innovator's dilemma.
No, you're right.
This
is it's how totally inevitable.
This is the life cycle of a
large company. Well, the innovator's dilemma is something different.
Well, it's related, though. The innovator's dilemma is that once your success... Well, but yes, but the problem is I think it's psychological in every way. Once you're a success, it's hard to throw away the success and approach the next thing with beginner's mind. You don't want to cannibalize your existing product, and it's hard for you to see the opportunities that exist.
I think maybe it was naive to think that Google could kind of avoid that or would be able to kind of continue being the same kind of company it was before. But I still sort of miss it in a way. I mean, maybe that's naive.
It's a very adolescent viewpoint. And I think this is part of like...
Are you calling me adolescent?
Are you saying this is the James Damore memo minus the sexism?
No, I mean, maybe. I think this is endemic to both Silicon Valley and to a class of people who are disruptors. And I think... this is a very important class of people to have. I don't want to denigrate this, but we've kind of, in the tech world, put this as
No, you're totally right. You're totally
right. And I think if you're that kind of person, yes, that would drive you.
Then you would move on. You go to a new startup.
Yeah.
So you're saying this is a middle-aged company, and this is what you do.
That's fair.
That's a life cycle that all companies go through, just like people can't stay adolescents forever. Like you might want to, but you see that, you know, 45-year-old guy with, you know, a toupee and his 20-year-old girlfriend in the red sports car. And you're like, buddy, you're not fooling anybody.
Yeah.
Just mature. I don't know. I mean,
I mean, I actually think Google, to be fair, does do a pretty good job of continuing to do stuff that is, you know, not just incrementally protecting their business, but they're still doing lots of stuff that's interesting, and they're still doing lots of stuff I sympathize with this guy's point. Maybe he's just not cut out for Google like it is now.
He wants to be at a startup. In fact, that's kind of what he says.
Which is fun.
He was at Amazon for 7 years before he went to Google. He does talk, though, I thought this was kind of interesting about being at Amazon and hearing Jeff Bezos in 1999 saying, "We're dead." And I thought that was really kind of an interesting, both Amazon and Google are well aware of the problem and have done what they can to prevent it. In Google's case, they kind of, every line of business is treated like a startup, has to justify its existence, its revenue. They really wanted everybody to act like a startup, even in a big company. For Amazon, I think it actually starts at the top with Jeff just spanking people a lot.
Not literally.
Well, I don't know.
We don't know.
Anyway.
But there's thoughts of tears. We know that much.
Let's not go there.
And things are getting faster. Wasn't it Justin Trudeau who just did a speech about how this is the slowest we're going to be innovating for like the next 100 years at this point. We're innovating so fast right now, but it's the slowest we're going to be innovating for the next, you know, 50 years.
Do you think that's accurate? That's really interesting.
How does he know?
I do. You know, he's Prime Minister of Canada. I don't know.
Okay, so I repeat my question.
But that's a reasonable...
He's got ministers.
It's a reasonable projection. I mean, that's what... that's what Ray Kurzweil said in his book, The Singularity is Near, is that the pace of growth is exponential. That it's not a straight line.
Right.
It's a hockey
and
stick.
And it's not just that change is occurring quickly, but the rate of change is increasing as well.
Precisely. Yeah. Right. And now Ray, unlike Justin Trudeau, but maybe Justin read the book, in that book, he has graph after graph after graph showing hockey sticks, basically, in many sectors of the economy. And so I think that that's fair to say. So what that means is if you looked ahead, everything's going to be growing at a faster rate.
If anything, that means companies like Google should be more adaptable, or they should be trying to evolve faster instead of getting less adaptable.
Google has done, I mean, he talks about Spanner and Waymo. Does he talk about like TPUs and the work that Google's done on machine learning?
Good point.
Fair.
I mean, yes, they have been neck and neck with Facebook, and maybe Facebook was a little bit ahead of them for a while. But Google had Jeff Hinton right actually before Facebook hired Jan LeCun, who now is in second in command there. So like, I can selectively look at a lot of things and say that was dumb or that, but I don't know.
I do think that they're particularly machine learning as far as Google's kind of smart assistant stuff is concerned. That is looking forward. I think there's going to be stuff they're doing there is going to be applicable in a whole range of ways that we haven't even discovered yet.
Maybe to this point, just a minute ago, Stephen Gillette announced that Google was going to spin off one of its ex companies, Chronicle, which is a security company. And their goal is to speed up security, to speed and impact of security team work by a factor of 10 to keep up, I guess, with the speed up in security flaws. That couldn't be more timely. That's the kind of thing. I mean, this is Google X. They have their moonshots. This was one of them. And they founded it in 2016. And a year and a half later, now they're launching it as a company. So maybe you're right. You know what? I think, Stacey, that's well put. This is a particular kind of person who needs a certain kind of company to scratch his itch.
Yeah.
And admittedly, Google is not that company anymore. But that's normal. It's not necessarily and this is the key. Is it a bad thing or not? And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a middle-aged company without the toupee, the red sports car, and the young.
But I do think that it's...
Okay, I'm going to say something about Silicon Valley and ageism. I do think that's a very big thing for Silicon Valley. They focus very much on disruption at the expense sometimes of scale and scaling in a mature fashion. And I think part of that is because Silicon Valley tends to hire younger and get rid of or not rehire older. So I think that might be kind of those two things are related.
Yeah. And I think as an old person, you know, I'm in favor of people respecting wisdom and gray hairs and all that other stuff. But I also think it's a tough challenge for a company like Google or Microsoft or Amazon to keep enough of those types of people around and in places where they can experiment and achieve interesting things. And because you need them, right? You can't have just all those people, but you need them, but they need to be in certain roles. And then you need other people who are going to do the boring stuff to keep the business going.
Actually, so,
but you've
got to
have that mix.
That's the big problem at Google. Is that everybody wants to be working on the next shiny new thing, and nobody wants to maintain the existing code base.
Right.
And that's
a problem.
That's a problem with, I mean, that's a problem endemic. I actually wrote about this a couple weeks ago, but that's a problem endemic to IT in a lot of ways. And as we bring, and I'll bring Internet of Things in here, but as we bring IT and sensors into old school industries like utilities and nuclear power plants and blah, 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 that is a huge culture clash, because these people are like, no, I don't want the new thing. I've got to keep this running. And what is this agile, move fast and break stuff?
That's a good point.
Get out of my nuclear power plant.
And there was a lot of criticism of Google. I remember certain products, you know, many of whose names I forget, where they got a criticism for, you know, oh, we're so just shutting engineers. That thing down. Remember that thing? Remember that thing that you kind of built into your user base? Well, it's gone now. And so good luck.
Actually, Yegi wrote a follow-up post today in Medium saying, I'm getting lots of calls from reporters asking me for a hot take on my claim that Google has lost the ability to innovate, but since I'm busy, I'm going to just... Most big companies don't innovate at a large scale. That's normal. You have two perfectly valid alternatives for responding to market shifts. You can acquire the innovator or one of their competitors, or you can build your own competing product and compete head-to-head. Acquisitions happen all the time. Google buying YouTube, Facebook buying Instagram, Amazon buying Twitch are all good examples. And then he's talking also about where he sees the next big thing, which is, I think, truthfully, the more interesting half of the memo, because he's explaining why he's going to Grab, which is a ride-hailing startup in Southeast Asia. But he says that in the Southeast Asia, where cash, mostly a cash economy, people live on their smartphones, there's an opportunity not just for ride-hailing, food delivery, and... At some point, once people have your Grab app on their phone, payments. So he's got an interesting roadmap.
He's totally right about that.
Grab, yeah,
yeah. I mean, there's an argument to be made that lots of those countries, by kind of leapfrogging straight to mobile,
right,
without going through the intervening periods that we did, have actually accelerated, like they're actually now on the leading edge instead of catching up.
Yeah, well, the U.S. is a classic example of the opposite.
Not catching up. And I think, to be honest, maybe we don't want to get into this, but I think you could argue that kind of move fast and break things mentality, when it's done at a company, say, the size of Facebook, can have some significant negative impacts. I mean, they've been moving fast and breaking democracy, you know, which isn't really the kind of thing you want to encourage.
I just read an article. I thought it was very interesting, or maybe it was a tweet, but somebody pointed out that all of the people who were involved at the beginning of Facebook, even including Mark Zuckerberg, but are basically don't use Facebook like normal people do. They mm-hmm. have very, you know, limited or no experience, you know. And of course, who was it? Was it Sean Parker and others who've decried social media and
Chamath Palihapitiya.
Yeah. And none of them use Facebook. So we're just the suckers who are still using it.
Well, and didn't Tim Cook say that he would never let his nephew use a social network?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very famously, Steve Jobs wouldn't let his kids have iPads. You know, he thought that they should grow up without technology. So maybe they know. Maybe Silicon Valley knows something that we don't know.
No, something. I will say, in the kids and technology, this is a thing that I've noticed. And then I talked to some of my friends who are not in my, who are out of town, so their kids are not friends with my kid. But my daughter spends all day long. She doesn't actually. She hates her phone. She has a phone for like emergency calls. She never remembers to charge it. She doesn't want to look at it. She doesn't want to text anyone. And her friends have phones too, and they're very similar. And I don't know if this is an age thing. But instead, you know, when she gets home, she goes upstairs to her room and just turns on Hangouts and gets on Hangouts with her friends, and they just hang out. But they don't actually talk to each other.
Right.
And they don't always have the video on.
Right.
But some of them will have their video on all the time.
With each other.
That's parallel play on the internet.
Yeah.
That's an interesting, because that's what my kids did, particularly Abby, the older one. So that was 10 years ago. They would be doing homework, but they'd have video of everybody on the screen, and they'd all be doing their, and then they could chat. I thought that is very interesting.
When they wanted to.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I think it's, so I'm like looking at that and I'm like, huh. She likes having the, I mean, it's basically like having your friend ambiently in your room via technology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she she goes downstairs to dinner and comes back to them. But she hates carrying the phone, and she hates being, she does not want to be instantly accessible via text or pick up the phone. I mean, if I ping her, like if I use the Madam A and I'm like, hang out or drop in on my daughter's name, she'll do it, but she'll talk to me for a brief second, but it's very strange. I just, I don't know.
By the way,
maybe as she gets old.
Go
ahead. Be my guest.
I was just going to say there was a company, I can't even remember the name of it, but I wanted to do this at GigaOM and had a bunch of remote offices. They set up a giant TV screen on a, was it Facebook on a cart?
Facebook had a wall of Skype.
No, this wasn't a wall of Skype. This was a window, they called it. So it literally just had a camera in their remote office, and people would just walk by and they would wave or you could talk to
them.
This
is very common.
Yeah, it was just like a window that you, so there was no, you didn't have to go and do things in the window, and they didn't have Skype Hangouts and they didn't have conference calls. It was literally just to wave or to, you know. It was just a virtual window into the other.
We had a sponsor, GoToMeeting, and that was a big use case for GoToMeeting. They would just leave it running all day.
Yeah.
So the people in remote offices would just be part of the. And I guess that's an interesting idea. Look how, I mean, I'm sitting here by myself. You guys are on Skype. I mean, this is how we do our shows.
One day I'll have the tactile punch Leo button.
I think this is, if for that reason alone, the better way of doing things.
Yeah.
You can't
punching
punch
is
me.
More virtual.
I don't think this is bad at all. This has become, I mean, I'm sure biologists and sociologists would say, oh, no, it's not a full experience. You know, it's missing something. But I think it's pretty close.
Well, it is. Sure, it is. But I think we have more variety of experiences now, whereas it used to be totally binary.
You're in Canada. Face-to-face. Stacey's in Texas. I'm in California. But we can have a round table conversation.
Right.
Admittedly, it's always better if you're all here, but it's hard to do.
Exactly. And before, you had to be in a room physically with someone, and then, you know, the telephone and the telegraph and so on extended things. Now we've just got more ways to interact. I know my wife used to talk about our daughter and say, I wish she would, you know, go play with her real friends instead of spending so much time online. But for her, those were her real
friends. They're real friends.
And she was spending time with them.
I kind of prefer it this way.
That's true. You know, you don't know if I've taken a shower today, so
I don't need
to know. Well, I like it. I'm basically not wearing pants. So, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot more freedom.
I remember what a shock it was when I found out that Terry Gross on Fresh Air rarely is in the same room with her interview guests. They never say that, but most of the time people are at another public radio station.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've done that. And it's
every time I call into those, it's weird.
Yeah.
People who are good at it can make you feel as though
you can't
like
tell.
They can erase that distance.
Yeah, in fact, if you didn't have video of the show, for those of you listening in audio, I don't think Skype is good enough now that I don't think there's much of a difference between you being in studio or not. Anyway.
Jeff and I get lagged when we talk
when it
over
works.
Each other.
That is the big thing. But, you know, if you don't know what to listen for, you wouldn't even know that. But you're right. That's one of the reasons people talk. People complain all the time about people talking over each other. And that's because they don't know. We're all latent. By the way, Stacey, I'm a little bit, I can't say mad at you. I'm a little bit mad. I'm a little bit grateful because I went out and got those Hue ambient lights that you talked about, the Hue Goes.
I like those. Yes.
And then I had to get a base station to control them. And then I had to get a few more bulbs. And then that wasn't enough. And I have more bulbs coming.
Now you're hooked.
Well, it's funny because I had Hue when they first came out.
Richer colors are so much nicer.
Everything's better. I had it like when the sun went down, my TV room would light up and stuff. And then when I moved, I didn't, you know, I put them in a box, but I didn't set them up. And I very recently actually gave them away to somebody. And now they sucked me back in again. But it's great in my office. You know what? I'm not going to put them in the bedroom because, as you know, if the power goes out and comes back, the Hues are on full.
They're just like, whoop, you're awake.
And that happened once. And I've told the story before, so I apologize if you heard it before. But I'm like, what happened? And I got my phone, and I'm trying to find the Hue app. And Lisa said, dummy, and went and turned the lights off. Because they were still
smart
on the
woman.
Switch. Yeah, dummy. But I'm not going to put them in the bedroom, but I kind of like it. And I want to do the ambient. What is that environmental thing where the TV matches the.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. And now they're actually pushing that. So I did it years ago when they launched it with Sharknado. It was awesome.
The only problem with that is you have to watch Sharknado.
Well, so my husband and I, we popped some popcorn and we decided cheesy movie night. We turned on the Hues. You had to actually have the app open and listening to your television so it knew where it was. But it was awesome because when the thunder would happen, your Hues would go poof, poof, like lightning. And then when the shark bit into
that's
a person,
so cool.
The lights go red. It was so campy. It was like it took it up like
now,
to 11.
Speaking of latency, is there any? I mean, that would be no good if you're watching TV and 3 seconds mm-hmm. later it does that.
No, it was right. On it was right along with the soundtrack, and they've done now they've got it much better. It's much nicer. They built like an SDK for directors.
Somebody's doing the Hue mix when he does the audio mix. He's doing the
nice.
Hue mix.
Yeah. So yes, I'm. But you have to put it in with like the movie people have to put it in. So it's only going to be a few things at first right. that are optimized
well,
for.
Well, I noticed that they gave me a number of channels that I can use with it. So I guess, so apparently it syncs up with Coco. Here's a video of the Hue lights. Let me see. Do we get the audio? So those are the orbs behind there that we were talking about, the go. Oh, look. Blue.
Philips did this with a television a while back.
But now it's doing it with the actual content.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the experience like? Does it feel like a better experience? I guess for Sharknado, it's great.
For Sharknado, they did it also with... I mean, Sharknado just... They were like, how campy can we make this? By right. golly. And it really did. It made it much more fun. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I was like, the first time the lightning flashed, I was like, whoa, cool. and then I giggled forever, you know, whenever the cheesy effects happened. So there are more subtle things. Like, it would be nice. Like, imagine, like, watching Alien or something scary. Mm-hmm. Your lights kind of were giving this clue. And it just kind of more immerses you in it. Is it make or break? No. Will it matter for something like Coco? I don't know. Maybe a kid will like it. I mean, they sync those things to like kid books right now. You can read your child a story to a Disney book and, you know, the Hue light will turn colors with the pages on. I mean, it's kind of silly.
So I'm not sure what it's going to take to set that up, but I now have plenty of devices.
Well, I will tell you your other thing. I'm sure you have it, but let me look.
I have
see
the hub. I have the goes, and then I have a bunch of bulbs, and they're all in my den. I have one in my. I mean,
I know Stacey gets a referral fee for everything.
I don't. I don't get anything for this.
It is
this
cool is though when you pair hooked. It with Google Home or Amazon's Echo. So it's cool that I could say, Echo, turn on the lights in the den.
Mm.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah. That would
and
be
if you do the Echo, if that Echo is only in your den and you group those lights with that Echo, you can actually just say, turn on the lights, and it will turn on the lights.
Well, that explains it because I go in the kitchen and I say, Echo, turn on the lights in the den. She says, I don't know what you're talking about. So I must have paired it to a particular Echo instead of to the...
Right.
Oh. This is so confusing.
Weird.
Here's a video.
We just got dimmer switches up here. So
Patrick Delahanty has given me a video from Engadget of Sharknado using
there you go.
Sci-Fi Sync. Oh, blood red. Oh, my.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Oh, my.
It's so campy fun.
Maybe I'm old, but.
No, it's purely cheese. It's awesome.
Cheese.
Now, this is, remember, on they're watching on a MacBook Air, so it's a tiny screen. If you had a big screen, it wouldn't be, the lights would not be overpowering the video like they are. On a big screen, it'd be, the lights would be accenting.
What are we watching?
Sharknado, baby.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Not that I know. It's just that's what it says.
I haven't.
Oh, look. A Ferris wheel has gotten loose.
That's a quality film right there.
Well, the title says it all.
Hue Disco. That's what you need.
Hue Disco.
It's a $4 app. It's on Android and iTunes. Okay.
I had to buy more lights.
No. And then anything you play, it'll do different lighting patterns. So all of our dance parties.
Oh, that's like a light organ.
Yeah.
So
can you do an actual disco, though?
Like a disco ball? I have one of those, too.
Oh, wow.
It is a party at Stacy's house. Holy cow. Crazy.
I don't know if you can do a disco ball. You could do strobe if you really wanted to upset the epileptics in your life. But I do that with the nano. Like when we have the nano art plus the Hue lights going, man, it's pretty awesome.
There's a Hue party app as well. There's a lot of apps. Hue Disco is not from Philips though.
No, it's not Hue, but Hue recommends it. They have an app store in there.
Yeah, I saw.
They have an app recommended thing.
All right. I don't know how I got off on this. Yesterday, President Trump struck out at Samsung. Where? I don't even understand. By the way, it's been debunked. 50,000.
Wait, you know what? Let's not even talk about it.
But
let's not talk about it.
I mean, okay. Yeah, let's. Why give in?
Why give?
You're going to George Lakoff.
It's like your drunk uncle.
Screw you, Samsung! It's your fault.
You kids nowadays.
You kids and your smartphones. The Verge used crowdsourcing to solve the Google I/O puzzle. More than 100 Discord users helped us at The Verge to solve the puzzle. So what you had to do is it starts with the tweet. Let's see if I can find the tweet. No, that was last year's. There's a binary tweet pinned to the top of the Google developer's Twitter account. Let me go to it. And I don't know how it goes from after that, but this is the tweet. And if you look at it, it's obviously zeros and ones. It's binary. So first you have to figure out what that is. Maybe it's a URL. It's probably not long enough to be a URL. But they nailed it. They got it. I/O 2018 will be May 8th through 10th at Shoreline. You have to apply to buy a ticket February 22nd. And I'm sure, Stacy, you'll be there.
Nope. You can watch most of it online.
I know. I don't even know why we go to these things anymore. I said after going to the last one.
Bags of free stuff. No?
What? They don't, you know, it's... What did we get? This was free this year. I don't even remember. It wasn't anything great.
But 1 year was cardboard, wasn't it?
Cardboard.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cardboard you could get free at like Best Buy.
Yeah, I know. That was a bad example.
First, the image and the Google's developer to translate from binary and points to google.com/IO. From there, you're taken to a Google Maps page with a splash screen. Let's see. Go behind the scenes, it says, look at this. Using Google technologies.
Pretty exciting.
This is Street View. Should we go inside? I don't know. I don't have a badge. Can I go in?
You can.
Ooh. No, I'm looking at the window. They don't let you in. Okay.
That's it?
I'm sure there's more. You got to explore around.
All right.
So, you're taking a Google Maps page of the splash screen. Once you begin walking around in the street view, you can walk into one of the company's office buildings. If you explore throughout the room, an identification icon will appear over different items. There's a calendar showing August 5th, which is National Sister Day, a plate of sushi, and the Sister Carrie book. If you try to get through the door on the other end, you're supposed to enter a city name that Google seeks. Based on all the sister clues, we discovered that the city the game was looking for was Mountain View's sister city, Iwata. Jeez. You really have to be. Fortunately, 9 to 5 Google. I mean, it goes on. The next location is a meeting room.
This is that arrogance/adolescent mindset. Who has time for this?
Yeah. The
Verge.
But
Any programmer on a deadline is thrilled to be doing this.
Right.
Then write that dumb login code.
It's very much targeted towards the people I think they're trying to attract.
I'm reading a wonderful book that Jeff Jarvis recommended from Kurt Anderson, who was one of the founders of Spy Magazine. He's been around. And it's called Fantasyland, 400 Years of Fantasy in America. And it ties right into something that's always bugged me, which is that we are all adolescents now, right? Between cosplay and Star Wars and action figures, even full-grown geeks are acting like 12-year-olds, right?
True. Is that so bad?
Yes!
That's mostly...
I don't know. Well, is it?
I want to shout. Maybe I'm getting old. Grow up, you kids!
I don't know. But
it's
is
all
growing
Samsung's
up so great?
Fault!
Growing up isn't that great. Let's admit it. Yeah. It's boring. It's stressful. I mean, if some guy wants to spend his weekends making a giant mech suit that he can wear to go to some cosplay event, I don't care. I think that's great, you know.
Okay, so
you'll be at a bar drinking, watching football.
Can we talk more about Chronicle? Because I still don't.
Yes.
Other than using Google's infrastructure to scan your data to detect security risks, is that it? This is where, like, I was reading about it and I'm like, I'm going to have to talk to somebody at Google because I don't understand what's...
Two services, security intelligence and analytics platform for enterprises and an online malware and virus scanner called VirusTotal. Oh, wait a minute. I know VirusTotal. Yeah, that's been around for a long time. Google acquired that in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, Google has a very good reputation for finding zero days. In fact, it was a Google research team that found, among others, but that found Spectre and Meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this they're trying to capitalize on this reputation. We talk all the time about Google's security research teams. I don't know if they'll be in Chronicle or not.
Well, they're saying that you have access to Google's infra. So this is going to be built on Google's infrastructure.
So, maybe it is. Yeah.
But then it sounds like you would give them all your business data and they would use their infrastructure to scan it.
What could possibly go wrong with that?
That is kind of what it sounds like.
I'm not trying to be snarky. Just trying to understand what it is.
I think, actually, though, if you're a CIO at a Fortune 500 company,
Amazon.
You're scared to death, right? Maybe not a Fortune 500 because you've got the resources, but maybe a Fortune 1000 or even a smaller company. You're scared to death because you see all these other companies. Merck took last year $300 million write-off because of WannaCry ransomware. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is terrifying. You look at what happened to Sony Pictures Entertainment.
God.
You look at what happened to Sheldon Adelson's casino back end company. I mean, these are companies, big enough companies to have absolutely great security, and they're not doing. So I think there's probably a fairly hefty market set of people saying help. And I think you'd probably trust Google that I've wondered this for some time. Is there ever been any record of Google's security failing?
Not that I can think of.
Even Apple, you know, with the iCloud hacks, has a bad tracker. I can't think of a single breach of Google services or systems. Not
it's
one.
It's all been hushed up.
Now, Matthew, you don't have any evidence of that. What would they say at the CJR?
Fake news.
Well, it's possible, but nowadays I don't think you can hush stuff up. I don't think there has been, and I think that's one of the few companies you can talk about. Even Facebook's had slip ups. Remember Mark Zuckerberg's private photos got posted to his public timeline? That's never happened to my knowledge at Google.
Both Google and Amazon seem to have. I can't think of anything with Amazon. So
I can't either. Actually, come to think of it. So I could see why you would trust Google. You know, I mean,
until, well,
you're
there's
desperate.
Also,
you're desperate.
The issue, though, is how far is Google going to encroach on your day-to-day business? Mm-hmm. So kind of the issue that companies who are in the logistics space are now thinking about with Amazon, they're like, oh, maybe I don't want to give Amazon all my data.
Right. Actually, and people are going to point out, well, Google owns Android, don't they? And there have been plenty of Android exploits out there. Sure. So maybe
not to mention all the major tech companies have, you know, have been handing data to the government pretty regularly.
Yeah. They can't help it.
If they ask nicely.
They can't stop it. You could fight it, but you're going to lose.
Occasionally they sue, but they don't sue all the time.
No.
I'm like, I don't know where their moral compass is, and it may not mesh with mine. Yeah. And there's no published rules. So, gosh, that's just tough.
No. Yeah. Secret courts are the best.
Yay. We got to talk about FISA.
FISA did get renewed, or the section, what is it, 702, the FISA?
The super secret.
Yeah.
Now, check me if I'm wrong. I read that that only affects foreign nationals overseas. Nobody in the U.S. at all. Not even foreign nationals in the U.S., right? I don't know.
Not sure about that.
The reason I read that is because that's why the president was glad to sign it, because it wasn't involved in spying on his campaign, right? 702, under authority, innocent Americans may be caught in upstream surveillance or prison.
Provided they're not the target.
Right.
So they can be sort of caught in the net.
Collateral damage.
Provided they're,
so 702 provided they're says the collection of foreign intelligence from non-Americans located outside the United States. So you can't, obviously, you cannot target Americans, but you can.
But if you happen to get some information from them accidentally.
Right. So if, for instance, you were to call the Russian ambassador in Russia from Trump Tower, that call would be swept up. It's supposed to be masked. The American is supposed to be masked.
Yeah.
There was an excellent Good Wife on this.
See, I get all my best stuff from Good Wife. Yeah. So 702, which would have sunsetted, has been renewed for another 5 years, I think.
Because basically all the security establishments and intelligence agencies said, we really, really need it.
And you don't want us to be...
Even though we can't tell you specifically what we've done with it or whether it works or not.
I mean, if you're a member of Congress or a senator, you don't want to be the guy who voted against that and there's some massive terrorist attack, right? You don't want to be responsible. You don't want to be soft.
That's the same sort of thing that gets enterprise software sales that, you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
that are
so
not innovative.
So SAP stays in business.
Yep. Hey, you want to talk about net neutrality?
Let's take a break and then talk about net neutrality. Because there's some good news. There's some good news. Out of the great state of Montana.
It is. Okay, Montana. All right. Okay. Let's talk about that.
Right. Which is where Carsten Bondi apparently is from.
We were going to talk about Burger King.
And we could talk about Burger King.
We are totally talking about
Burger King. Is there net neutrality at Burger King? Really?
After the break, you can see the video. Okay.
I can't
Burger
wait.
Neutrality.
Burger neutrality. But first, a word from our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Quicken Loans, the best lender in the country, number one in customer satisfaction year after year, according to J.D. Power, both in mortgage approval and mortgage servicing. And that was even before they invented Rocket Mortgage, which to me, as a geek, is the number one way to apply for a home loan or a refi because it's entirely online. No more going to the bank. No more going to the attic to get paperwork. You could do it all online. You could do it from your phone at an open house, and it takes minutes. This is awesome. Actually, right now, go to rocketmortgage.com/twig. Bookmark it. Maybe even get the process started so that it's there. It's in your phone. It's ready to go. And then if you say, you're at an open house and you say, I want this house. I want it. I love it. I want it. I need it. You can just finish the process. You give them some basic information that's already in your head. Name, address, birth date, social, that kind of thing. They have relationships with all the financial institutions, secure connections, so they can say with your permission, okay, let's pull his stuff. They crunch the numbers. All of this is happening like lickety-split because it's computerized. There's no humans. Based on your income, assets, and credit, they will analyze all the options out there, and they'll offer you the ones that you qualify for. You choose the term, the rate, the down payment, and the loan is yours. You're approved. Big green button right on the screen. Approved. Show that to the realtor or press the button that says print out a letter. If your realtor really wants a piece of paper, print out a letter, and you could do that. In minutes, this whole thing took no time at all. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. You will apply simply. You will understand fully every step of the way. And then, of course, because of that, mortgage confidently. RocketMortgage.com/twig. RocketMortgage.com/twig. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of this week in Google. Net neutrality. So I'll give you what maybe it's the good news. State of Montana has voted that if you want to do business in Montana as an internet service provider, you have to be net neutral. That's a good thing, right? What could possibly?
Yeah, no, that's definitely good news.
If all the states do this. Yeah.
If California did it, it would be a big thing. Montana's, it's populous, but it's not like
so populous. Against Montana.
I'm just saying that Montana, like a rural area, most of them don't want to serve rural areas anyway, because it's highly expensive. If they can get out of that, they would. So imagine if you're like, you have to be net neutral. And they're like, oh, okay, never mind. Bye-bye.
You know, it's cool. It was an executive order. The governor, Stephen Bullock, just declared Monday that any internet service provider with a state government contract cannot block or charge more for faster delivery of websites to any customer in the state. However, of course, remember the FCC said we don't want the states to make their own rules.
Right.
So there could be legal challenges.
But I admire them for doing that. I think it's still worthwhile that they're even trying to do it. That's better than lots of places.
And then this one, Randall Stevenson, of the CEO of AT&T, said AT&T is committed. They bought big, full-page ads in a bunch of newspapers saying they want net neutrality. AT&T is committed to an open internet. We don't block websites. We don't censor online content. We don't throttle, discriminate, or degrade network performance based on content
pyramid. But they want zero rating.
Well, and they also want Facebook and Google, their arch nemeses, to be subject to regulations as well.
Right.
They are trying this is their...
Okay, I'd go for that.
Gambit. It's a gambit.
Wrong. It's a different... They need to be regulated in a different way. I'm not going to argue that we should not do some form of regulation over maybe data monopolies. I actually had a guest on my podcast talking about what an anti-competitive regime for the 21st century looks like. And it was really interesting.
I have to admit, when you read that it's AT&T, you scratch your head and go, okay, what are they up to? Because they have never been really fans.
Well, they want their definition of net neutrality. So their definition allows them to do things like zero rating, which I think should not be allowed.
They want the Congress to pass, and which, by the way, I think the congressional solution is the right solution if you can get congressional agreement. And we're one vote away in the Senate, but that doesn't mean it's even close to passing in the House. Congressional action, writes AT&T, is needed to establish an internet bill of rights that applies to all internet companies, by which they mean us and the information services, and guarantees neutrality, transparency, openness, non-discrimination, and privacy protection for all internet users. You know what? Tell me why that's a bad thing, Stacey.
So my issue is regulating ISPs. Net neutrality is a solution for
providers.
A lack of competition. It's a lack of competition at an infrastructure level.
Okay.
Now, it is the right solution. So common carriage type of rules are the right solution when you're dealing with physical infrastructure in a non-competitive market. Now, where it gets interesting is when AT&T is like, let's do the same rules. We'll follow the same rules that Google and Facebook do. I don't think that's right, because they're in a very different competitive environment. Their competitive environment isn't necessarily based on physical infrastructure, although their data centers are a huge element of that, right? But their competitive advantage is based on data. So then they should be regulated based on that competitive advantage. So what you really need is two separate laws. And you can talk about, yes, you have other, Google is still, you know, I use DuckDuckGo, you know, I don't have to use Google, you can use Bing, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there is a data monopoly developing among the big companies. And we do need to look at that and figure out a solution for making sure that having all of this information doesn't create a barrier to other companies being able to come in and innovate. And that's fine. I think that makes sense. I just don't putting the same rules around them in AT&T don't make sense at all, because AT&T is providing physical infrastructure.
Physical access. Exactly. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's definitely issues around Facebook and Google and probably Amazon too. I mean,
yes,
competition, sort of competition policy just isn't equipped to deal with things like network effects. And, you know, it was designed to deal with physical assets. Like, I control all the railway cars, or I control all the barrels of oil or whatever. Facebook doesn't control anything tangible except a lot of data that people willingly provide it, which is a completely different animal.
Meanwhile, Amazon, Facebook, and Google are spending more money lobbying than ever before.
That's because they know this is coming.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Something
I'm
is coming.
I'm trying to think. Something is coming. So
actually, $50 million doesn't really sound like that much.
No, but Congress is cheaper than you think.
Yeah, I suppose. Running Senators are particularly cheap. Ugh.
All right, so Amazon spent $12.8 million lobbying, four times what it spent 4 years earlier. Facebook spent also a record amount, $11.5 million. Apple spent $7 million. Of course,
you know, $12 million for Jeff Bezos, that's like me spending $1.50 on a cup of coffee.
It literally is.
It's actually probably less than that.
It's probably less than that. He's so somebody I saw did
$113 billion.
I
want to
do a spreadsheet because he's worth $113 billion. Let's say I'm worth $1 million. He's worth 113,000 more than I am, right? So that means that every $113,000 I spend is worth $1 to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
So $12 million is like 10 bucks.
Yeah.
It's a little more than 10 bucks. It's like,
I think someone,
he probably has it in his wallet. He probably has it in the cushions of his couch.
Someone said his net worth increased $2.8 billion.
Daily.
And that's 10 times as much. That's in a single day. That's 10 times as much as all the cashiers who work in retail in the United States.
By the way, that number is going to dwindle quickly. Amazon Go opened on Monday, the first convenience store with no clerks. And I cannot, am I a bad person for saying I cannot wait for them to open here? I love the idea. I walk into the store, you scan your phone, right? Because I think eventually they'll use Bluetooth LE or something to identify you. But so eventually, I think by the time it gets here, you won't even have to scan your phone. You'll just walk in, take what you want, and walk out, and you'll be billed. I love that. No scanning of any kind. Just take what you want. What do you like that? Take it. You want that? Take it. It's a dream for everybody. It's a dream for Jeff because you're going to take more stuff. And it's a dream.
I'm not sure it's a dream for poor people.
No,
I think it's a dream.
It's a dream for rich people. You're right.
Yeah.
People with disposable income. But you still have to shop. If you have to shop, wouldn't it be better just to put that peanut butter in your pocket and walk out? Don't bring small children, though, because you know what children do. They just grab it. You'd come home, you'd have eight bags of peanut M&Ms.
I mean, convenience-wise, it's definitely great. It sounds fantastic, but...
You know what is better?
What?
Pickup. Grocery store pickup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They just bring it
to
you.
That's all I need. They just bring it to you.
But you know what they need is pickup and put away.
Okay, I can put away my groceies.
No, I'm lazy. I want to be sitting.
I'm willing, you know, if they take out the shopping trip, I am willing to put away the groceries.
Remember when Amazon Key came out and they were going to give their drop-off people a key to your apartment or whatever?
Again, if they'd put stuff away, I'd go for it.
Well, someone said the next the next evolution will be Amazon Warehouse, where you literally just live in the warehouse. And then stuff doesn't have to come to you at all.
That solves the last mile problem.
Just bring it to you.
But isn't really Amazon Go is exactly that. It's basically a little Amazon warehouse.
Yeah.
And you just, you do the pick and pull. You go, you pull what you want, and you walk out the door. It's exactly what that is. It's a little mini Amazon warehouse. And I expect
And I'm sure, you know, they'll need people to calibrate the video cameras or, you know, stock the shelves or something, right?
You work at home, Stacey, so you don't, but if you were working downtown, you would love it that when you know, lunchtime came, you went down. And by the way, it wouldn't necessarily be of any particular size. It could be like that bodega thing, the fake bodegas. They're just a vending machine. It could just be a little closet in your office. You just take stuff from.
No, that's been a very popular idea for years, is that kind of stuff, vending machine. If actually Facebook has had their own little vending machines that distribute office supplies with your Facebook ID.
Yeah. Really?
You know, you just go up and you take your keyboard or you take your...
What?
I don't know. Yeah, they have vending machines full of stuff. And great you idea. Use your Facebook. You actually use your badge. You just scan your badge. You grab the thing.
Christmas Day this year, I didn't know about this, but somebody in the chat room just gave me the link because it was part of the regional version of the New York Times. They talked about businesses, a growing number of businesses that don't take cash at all.
Yeah.
It's all credit cards or debit cards.
I can hardly wait for that.
Or Apple Pay.
So I don't carry cash, but my daughter doesn't. She carries cash. We pay her allowance in cash.
Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't have to. Amazon now has allowances. I could put all of her money towards Amazon. She's 12, 11. She's 11.
It's a little young for a credit card, I guess.
Right. So what do you do? And honestly, you know how credit cards used to prey on, you know, kids in college. I don't actually think kids in college should have credit cards.
That's
unless
true.
They're,
but that's how you establish
credit. Really, I have a kid in college and I can agree with you 100%.
Last night, Henry said he has a credit card of mine for emergencies. Both my kids do for emergencies.
Emergency.
He says, okay, if I go Christmas shopping with your credit card.
That's an emergency.
I said, Henry, it's January 24th. What are you talking about?
I said, that's when all the sales are.
Yeah. He's going Christmas shopping. Christmas shopping. So there are a number of businesses in Petaluma, I guess we're very old-fashioned, that don't take credit cards. They only take cash, which is a big annoyance because you always have to remember to have enough cash to pay for your lunch, but I guess the real trend is going the other direction. Wow. So what do we do if we're entering a really interesting world of work. Your kids, your child, Stacey, our kids are...
All of our kids.
Are already older and suffering. The world of work is just falling apart. There are no entry-level jobs.
That's the thing. Cashier... cab driver, truck driver.
They're disappearing.
My first job was a cashier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My first job was working at McDonald's. I suppose they still have people there, but that's not for long. How about this?
Gas.
How about this Burger King?
Oh, yeah. We forgot to talk about that. Yes.
I am really jumping all over today. I apologize. Burger King deviously explains net neutrality by making people wait longer for Whoppers. That is pretty awesome. Is this real?
Yeah.
They really did this to people and recorded it. And apparently some people.
Whopper neutrality. Net neutrality was just repealed.
It was.
And it's very confusing.
With net neutrality, you know, some people, for what it's worth, just...
How come no one ever stops me on the streets and asks to find these terms?
I don't know exactly what it is.
Because if they did and they recorded it, they wouldn't use it.
They wouldn't use it, exactly.
Right.
It's that same thing with, you know, they do that on the late shows, right? They ask people, who's the president of the United States? Eugene Debs? And then, actually, that's exactly what you
the
don't
smart
get.
Ones they throw up.
Like, a socialist revolutionary for the
that's
three.
Exactly
okay,
what
sure.
you don't get. King Kong? And everybody laughs at how stupid people are. But that's because they asked 20 people to get the really dumb. I presume. Maybe not.
Okay, sorry. Back to the
Whopper neutrality.
Number one.
Hey, how you doing?
You know what number 98, what's going on with it?
Number 98, you got the Whopper?
Yeah.
So you got the slow access Whopper pass?
Slow access Whopper pass.
It's on the menu right there with the fast, medium, and slow. Slow MBPS, fast MBPS, or hyper fast MBPS. MBPS
burgers
for
per
standing
second,
for yes. Making burgers per second.
So if you want a Whopper now, we have to pay $26?
Well, that's how you get it fast. That's the highest priority.
This is like a lane system?
Maybe like 15, yeah, fast lane, slow lane. So like maybe like 15, 20 minutes.
He gets it. That
what
guy gets it.
What are you talking about?
Make more money selling like chicken sandwiches and chicken fries, and now they're slowing down the access to the Whopper. Yeah. Were you given an option of a chicken sandwich or?
Yeah, I don't want a chicken sandwich, Robert. I want a Whopper.
Do you have any Whoppers ready?
I admire Burger King for being willing to annoy the hell out of it.
I wonder if anybody got
the
punched.
Sandwich is ready. I'm just not allowed to actually get it to
what?
You.
You can't give me the sandwich. It's ready, but you can't give it to me.
Whopper neutrality was repealed. They voted on it.
Whopper what?
Whopper neutrality.
Fortunately, I have no other choice.
This is the worst thing I've ever heard of.
See, like, you got the fast.
Whopper neutrality is repealed.
Are you kidding me? You paid $26 for a Whopper?
That is my favorite part.
Are you kidding me?
Some guy actually paid $20.
If, guys, like, I want a burger, man.
If you'd like, if
this
you...
is a bad dream right now. I just want a burger, brother. A burger.
You
want
a
burger? I feel like I'm going to say this is crazy.
Well, here's what I'll do. You have the bag. And I can put it in the bag in 42 seconds.
He's taking it.
10 seconds. We don't make the rules.
No.
I presume these guys are not actual employees.
Fortunately, we have to.
They have to be actors,
no,
right?
They got
I feel like
actors.
I was being taken advantage of, in a sense. Just as a customer coming in to get their food, it's felt like a power move.
They already changed the policies overnight or whatever.
I didn't think that.
This is brilliant.
Ordering a Whopper would
thank
really
you, Burger King.
Open my eyes up to net neutrality.
The Whopper actually taught me about net neutrality. It's stupid, but true.
Stupid, but true.
That is...
That's my favorite line.
I am
going to
cry. That's awesome. Why did the king do that? That's brilliant.
I don't like the king.
I know, the king is creepy as hell. Can I just say?
The king is creepy as heck. But that was a good video. Stupid, but true.
I had somebody call the radio show yesterday or Sunday, Matthew, and say, what is going on with net neutrality in Canada? And I said, I don't know. What is going on with net neutrality? I said, if it's bad here, it might be bad up there. I don't know. What's going on?
I mean, nothing really. Like, it hasn't changed that much.
You have it, right? Do you have it?
No.
Okay.
So we kind of have it, but not really. I mean, our market is very different. We only have really two major carriers.
We have no competition, so, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not really, and maybe we should have had net neutrality a long time ago.
Yeah.
The thing that's disturbing, the more recent thing, is that the carriers are basically arguing that they would like to have a special organization that decides what websites you can go to and what websites you can't go to. Yeah, so it's a little like, do you remember SOPA and PIPA?
Yeah.
It's sort of like that. So they want to have a piracy council, totally independent, of course, that would decide which websites you could go to or not go to. And so they're kind of lobbying the government to give them, to give this totally independent piracy council that ability.
Do you have Burger King in Canada?
We do have Burger King.
Just checking.
Yeah.
I am now going to shop. I'm going to go buy a Whopper at full price.
It's not as good as Harvey's, though.
No, Whoppers are terrible. But I really, they're right next
door.
I find
it amazing people didn't just leave, though. So they were arguing.
I'm sure a lot of people did
and swearing.
But you don't know. You already paid your money.
Yeah, I suppose.
You're not going to leave without your burger.
And then you found out.
Even if it's going to take another 42 seconds.
Was the guy who paid $26 a real dude, though? Like, did someone actually do that?
I don't know.
You got to really want a burger.
those were actors. People have identified them. In fact, one of them was Reagan Burns, the guy who did the UMA TV ads. But I really think, gosh, kudos to Burger King.
That's a good metaphor.
And if you'd see more... American brands stand up for this. I think this would not be, it would be a little bit more of a fair fight, frankly.
I feel like my friends in DC who have fought for net neutrality for a while, they've said basically that the big brands who were behind them the last go round have not been behind them this go round. They've been very much, they've been very ambivalent. Yeah. And Washington is very aware of that.
And that's why they can do it.
Yeah. That's why Pi was like, I don't care. This is going to happen.
That's interesting. And why do you think that is, Stacey? Is it because they're the incumbents and they don't need to worry about the little guy getting shafted?
Yeah. I think part of it's they're the incumbents, but also they're about to engage in, they're prepping for war with Congress over their data practices.
Right.
So part of it is just, hey, we fought this fight, by golly, and we're about to have some big fish to fry. Like breaking democracy fish.
Wow. And then there's the Atlantic article on raising a social media star. And I bet I bet both of you looked at this and went, knock on wood.
Yes.
I didn't read it. I bookmarked it, but I haven't gotten there yet.
So it starts off with Jonas Bridges. When 14-year-old, he's not 14 anymore, but when he was 14, he ran down the stairs of his Atlanta home shouting, "Dad, I've got 1,000 fans." His father, Rob Bridges, hardly took notice. A few days later, Jonas barreled into the living room saying, "Dad, I've got 3,000 fans now." Several days later, 5,000. "And if I get to 10,000, I get paid for it." Finally, Rob Bridges turned to his wife and said, "Denise, what the hell is he talking about?" He was rapidly becoming famous on YouNow, which I don't know of, a social video platform. He'd been hosting live streams from his bedroom under the pseudonym, "Whoa, it's Jonas." Now, if you see a picture of Jonas, you see the secret of his success is blue eyes, blonde hair, and a very adorable punim. And, you know, frankly, I think it helps a lot to be super cute these days.
It's always helped a lot to be super cute.
It's always helped, hasn't it?
It's helped me.
He's kind of a teen. He's kind of a teen idol. And I think they say, let's see. Parenting these young stars is not easy. As social platforms rise and fall, moms and dads across the country with zero experience in the entertainment industry are seeing their families' lives transformed. Apparently, people call, you know, offering management deals, some of them legit, some of them scammers.
Yeah. There was a great article. I'm trying to remember if it was The Atlantic or New Yorker. It was about a girl slash woman. I think she was 18, 19, and she wasn't anybody famous, and she didn't, I think her father was a doctor or something like that, but she had developed this massive following on Instagram because she was attractive and she kind of was on the periphery of sort of rich people. So she got invited to things and she was making tens of thousands of dollars a month, just sponsorships and, you know, endorsing things. And, but it, there was this undercurrent of, she clearly was not happy. So now it was like a job, you know, looking the
like
right way and going to the right parties.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's notoriously corrupting and depressing.
Yeah, it was kind of a very, very disturbing article because she couldn't actually enjoy any of the normal things that an 18 or 19-year-old person would do because she had to keep thinking about, am I going to the right parties? Am I seen with the right people? Do I look good? Am I going to get those ads or whatever?
But we know as parents, if your if your daughter Stacy suddenly said, "I'm going to do this," it wouldn't do much good to say, "Well, it's not going to make you happy.
True.
You can't do it."
Yeah, true.
You just try to set realistic expectations. I mean, like my daughter looks, because we have a YouTube channel. That was the most exciting thing I think I've ever done in my life for her, was create a YouTube channel for like the podcast stuff. And she's like, "How many subscribers do you have?" Like every day for the first like 2 weeks, she's like, I was like, I don't know. And she was baffled that I didn't know. And then she's like, "Oh, Mom, you only have 43. And I was like, "It's okay. It's new. We're not really marketing it." She's like, oh.
It's huge social currency for them.
Yeah.
My son says, "Please let me run your Instagram account. I could get you so many more follows and likes." It's like, no, Henry, I'm really happy with the number of follows. And like, it's a different, for them, it's the most important thing.
But the pressure it puts
thing.
On kids. It's yeah, terrible. The pressure it puts on them, I think, is there was a kid, I was over at a friend's for dinner and another friend was there who has a son. And I think he was 14 at the time. And I was interviewing him like I usually do, you know, what kind of social media do you use? Are you on Twitter? No, only weirdos are on Twitter. He said, you know, I like Instagram. And I said, oh, I'm on Instagram. And he said, oh, how many followers do you have? And I said, I don't know. I'll look it up. Oh, I've got like 5,500 or something. He says, what? And he jumped up off the couch and he ran across the room and he jammed himself in between me and my daughter where there was no room for anyone to sit. And he was like, what do you post? What kind of hashtags do you use? How did you get so many followers? What do you? And I was like, dude, I just post photos of like kayaks and sunsets and stuff. Like, I don't even use hashtags, but he was obsessed. He would not let it go.
It's huge. It's huge for them. Now, a lot of this goes back to Vine.
Yeah.
Which Twitter bought and killed. But yeah. Get ready. It's coming back.
Coming back. Vine 2.
Or V2. So the guy who founded Vine, Dom Hoffman, and sold it to Twitter, somehow, I guess he's not, doesn't have a non-compete, or maybe it's expired. He's going to create V2.
Yeah, don't call it Vine.
Don't call it Vine 2.
Vine 2, The Reckoning.
Twitter acquired Vine in 2013. So, yeah, I'm sure the non-compete has run out. So he says that it's going to be a little bit different. He says, don't call it Vine. Yep, because we don't want to get sold. It'll be V2.co. Although, look at the Vine logo and look at the V2 logo. Mm. You tell me.
Similar.
Sometime in 2018, he says, hopefully when it's warm in the Northern Hemisphere, whatever that means.
Vine was an amazing thing.
And it created many superstars.
And the creativity that you could see on there, I talked to people at Twitter at the time about how I thought Twitter was not taking advantage of Vine the way it should have. Yeah. And I know a lot of the sort of stars, quote unquote, on Vine felt the same, that they were not getting kind of paid attention to the way they should have been.
Their videos will range, much like Vine, from 2 to 6.5 seconds. Vine was 6, right?
Yeah.
6 or 8.
Or maybe it was a little longer. They'll loop over and over, just like Vine. There will be no color filters, face filters, or geo filters, at least to start. I don't know. He says we don't want, and we'll also take down copyrighted content.
He's getting a do-over. How nice for him.
He's getting a do-over.
Back at it again with the white vans.
Did you guys... stricter moderation, no name-calling, or harassment, direct or indirect, will be allowed. He wants
I remember watching my daughter, the people she followed on Vine, there was a guy who clearly wanted to be an actor or might have been an actor, and he was doing these little bits. So it was just like it was like he was workshopping characters He would do these little bits where it was like 6 seconds of just a character. And it was fascinating.
This is, by the way, where Logan Paul started. Reprehensible, who is now back. He has posted a new anti-video suicide and pledged $1 million to suicide prevention.
Anti-suicide video, I think you mean.
What did I say? Suicide video?
Anti-video suicide.
Well, no, arguably the first one was an anti-video suicide. This one is an anti-suicide.
But he's not in preferred anymore, right? They took him out of the preferred.
Yeah, no, he already lost a lot of revenue, presumably.
And then they changed the criteria.
But he must have made a lot of money if he's donating $1 million.
I think he made a lot of money.
Holy cow. Wow.
Well, I mean... a couple things. Kids have always been super passionate, like tweens and teenage girls. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're known for that. And they have been over forever. Even the Salem witch trials, let's go that far back.
Wow.
So if you think about YouTube in these, like the stars there, it makes total sense that this becomes this huge social currency. It becomes all important in their lives, and they go crazy in a way that is weird to us because we're beyond it. But
well, I mean, and it's just like, it's like Hollywood, like child actors, right? Except now anybody can be effectively a child actor by having their own YouTube channel. But you see the same
way you become famous is more,
yeah,
is less remote. I mean, no, you become right. famous you're because right. you interact with these people.
Yeah. But there's still the same push for sort of everybody wants to see someone flame out publicly. Everybody wants to see something horrible happen. Then there's the redemption story. I mean, it's a classic, you know, it's happened with every young actor I can think of, and musicians too, like Justin Bieber.
So here's some names that you may remember from Vine.
I had to mention him.
Jesse Smiles, Amy Marie Gertner. Shawn Mendes, Carter Reynolds, Casey James, Lance 210, Brandon Cavillo. Now, where are they now, I wonder? Us the Duo.
A bunch of them are on YouTube.
Yeah, a lot of them went to YouTube, like Logan Paul and his brother.
Shawn Mendes went platinum.
To Hollywood, yeah.
Is he famous?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's like a massive girl star. Pop duo.
Yeah. Canadian singer-songwriter?
Signed with Island Records.
Oh my God.
He's Canadian, too.
Yeah.
So
I guess you guys have nothing to do but sit inside and play guitar and do cheesy pop songs.
Sundown, you better take care. I can tell what he's singing. You better my back stair.
He's singing the Railroad Trilogy, I think.
Yeah, that's it. Lance 210, I mentioned him, the US dude. Nicholas Magalis. Tell me if any of these are famous besides Mendes. David Lopez. DeStorm Power. They're all, but that's funny, is they're all really short 6-second clips. I mean, it's really kind of weird. Matthew Espinosa, Jack and Jack, Thomas Sanders, Lily Pons is huge. I remember she's still around.
These people could be famous and we would never know.
Well, they were really famous. I mean,
they couldn't go in. I didn't know who.
No, you didn't know, but they couldn't go in public. I mean, they were that famous. Brett Rivera. If there were teens around. This guy is mentioned in the Atlantic article. His parents didn't know he was famous until he went to a hockey game, and a mom comes down and sits next to him and says, "My daughter's having her 13th birthday party here. They're up behind us. Could you just wave at them?" And he waved, and they went crazy screaming. And his dad said, "What the hell? What? I still see Lily Pons on Twitter. I guess, you know, this is a medium of 6-second sight gags, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them are really powerful in a weird sort of way.
Yeah. But I mean,
not that one.
Yeah.
That actually speaks to a universal experience for all women.
It does.
Leaving your phone in the cab and then running after
and having it fall out of your pocket as you sit down.
Yeah. Yeah, that happened to Lisa. Yeah. Cameron Dallas. Oh, I remember them. He is in a new movie coming out soon called Expelled. I think it came out.
Yeah, my favorite was when they would act like multiple characters in a single.
Right. They put a lot of work. I mean, these are a lot of work.
Yeah.
Jerry Perpdrank.
That's not a real name. Sorry.
Josh Peck. He was on Drake and Josh before, so he actually went the other direction. Curtis Lepore?
Never heard of him.
Never heard of him. Rudy Mancuso?
I'm sure he's never heard of me either.
He's the Spanish Batman and the Spanish Superman. I could see, like, the temporary popularity of these, but...
again, it's kids.
Not what you would call...
It's kids, yeah.
And this is their TV. They were super shareable.
Yeah, that was good.
You didn't have to sit there for an hour and watch a show.
Yeah. And it's all kids talking to kids, right? These are all teenagers, pretty much.
Oh, he's in the same movie as that other one. That guy above. No.
Yeah, the other one had a lot.
He's also an Expelled.
Yeah, I got to find out more about this movie. Did it ever come out?
Hmm.
This is an Expelled star. This is an older article.
This is 3 years title. Ago.
Expelled, I know. Expelled from Vine, actually.
It did come out.
It did come out. And what was the Rotten Tomatoes score?
2014. 5 out of 10 on IMDb.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
It's not
Ooh,
great.
Guys, I have a recommendation for y'all.
All right.
What? I know what? We're not there yet, but.
What?
Paddington 2.
Is it good?
It was so good.
It had 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's the highest scoring Rotten Tomatoes movie of all time.
Lady Bird was there, but then one jackass gave it a negative review.
So that if you get 100% means there are zero bad reviews?
Yeah.
I mean, someone has probably come in and given it. It's very cute. I mean, obviously, you would not go to see this if you were, you know, not into it.
Lisa and I live by Rotten Tomatoes, but I don't think this is going to get us in the theater.
This may not be for you, but as a, like, I mean, I have to go to lots of kid-appropriate shows, and this one was really fun, and it was just a sweet, good movie.
Well,
you know,
what I
like you would,
and Hugh Grant is in it.
When I was young, is Hugh Paddington?
Cheesy. No,
he's the villain. Oh my gosh, and he is hilarious.
Oh,
he's
so
hilarious.
It's a live-action animation.
The musical numbers are
yes.
What I loved this book when I was a kid, and I read it to my kids, I'm pretty sure.
Did you see Paddington, the original one?
Look! Cub! Lower me down. We've got a cub to raise.
What's he like?
He likes his marmalade. I have a feeling he'll go far.
Oh, Lord.
Dear Aunt Lucy.
Yeah, he's famous for his blue raincoat and his red hat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first Paddington's really cute, and I think it's like on Netflix. So, again, you may not watch it, but like it's got a lot of slapstick humor. It's a well-done family movie, basically.
Nice.
So, yes, you don't have to. Like, it's not for everyone.
Did it get an Oscar nod?
I don't think so.
Someone in the chat room said, I want to see Paddington versus Ted.
Yeah, that's kind of the good bear versus the bad bear.
Bad bear.
No, the animated features, that's the problem with these mixed ones. You don't know if it's animated or what.
Part of it is.
The nominated animated features are Boss Baby, Breadwinner, Coco, Ferdinand.
Coco is really great.
Coco's supposed to be very good.
It's fantastic.
The Breadwinner is really good.
Okay.
It's very depressing.
But Loving Vincent.
Boss Baby?
Yeah, Boss Baby. Loving Vincent's for grown-ups. That's an animated story about Vincent van Gogh, but it's not.
That's amazing, too, actually.
It's like his paintings came to life. Right.
Came to life. It's incredible. The amount of work that went into that film is mind-boggling.
Well, especially since Vincent's not painting anymore.
Right.
You have to get people who can duplicate that style. Android 8.1 now can display your Wi-Fi speed before you connect, so you know if it's worth connecting. When you see a public Wi-Fi hotspot, it will be labeled very fast, okay, or slow.
And I bet 97% of the time it will say slow to zero.
Yeah. Public Wi-Fi ain't noted for its speed.
It's almost always the worst.
Yeah.
Well, it's also full of all sorts of malicious goings on, which I imagine.
But I think they under-provision as well, I'll bet you.
Well,
I don't know.
Why would you over-provision?
Yeah.
Exactly. That'd be like cleaning the streets or building highways with enough capacity.
Yeah, putting enough bathrooms around. Why would you do that?
Oh, don't even complain, Matthew. Do not even complain.
So did you, any of you watch the event that MSNBC did with Recode, a Kara Switcher, and Ari Melba?
No.
Why was this a big deal?
Well, Sundar Pichai, Susan Wojcicki on stage.
Why was it a big deal that he said, because this is where he said that he didn't regret firing that dude?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so why
and
was that,
AI
that headline?
Was as good as
because
fire.
You know why? I'll tell you why. Because CEOs never say anything interesting.
True.
That's the
true.
The best they could get out of him was that, and Sundar Pichai compares the impact of AI to electricity and fire.
Yeah. Which he's done at Google I.O. a bunch of times.
I know. That just tells me we didn't miss anything.
I think fire, I would still give it to fire myself.
I think it's more like electricity.
Yeah. Yeah,
fire is the big winner in that.
For sure. I think if you look at historically, I would say fire wins.
Kevin Kelly, actually, we did a triangulation with Kevin Kelly. He wrote his last book was about the future. And he actually said that it's going to be very much like when electricity became widespread, what all the inventors did was they would apply a thin layer of electricity and they'd get this new invention. So he said, for instance, look at the pump, you know, and out in the yard, the hand pump where you get your water. Yeah. They applied electricity to it, suddenly you've got running water. And he says AI is going to be like that. You're going to take existing, and I think he was absolutely right. This was last year. Take existing technologies and you apply a thin layer of AI, and you've got an AI sandwich.
And arguably, the internet did that as well. I mean, electricity in the earlier days, you had, you know, Bob and Doug's electric company provided lights for like a block. Right. And so you had hundreds of thousands of these little electric providers, and then they all got rolled up. And
Waymo is going to put its self-driving vans in Atlanta. More and more, you're going to be able to try an autonomous vehicle.
I'd love to.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah. What do you think, South By? You think they'll have autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, they usually have autonomous vehicles. South By, I believe. I want an
autonomous pedicab.
Okay.
Oh, like an autonomous moped kind of thing?
No, you know how they have those guys in Austin that are bicycling around?
So you would have to build a robot that would pedal?
Yeah.
That's silly. That's inefficient.
A pedaling robot.
Well, they had pole dancing robots, didn't they, at CES?
Okay, that was so
I know. It was
stupid. It was offensive.
Don't get me started.
And it was stupid.
You know what's stupid? Is that robot, what's her name, the one everybody keeps talking to?
Yeah, the one that Yann LeCun hates.
It's so bad. So it's bad. Not a robot.
No,
it's terrible.
It's no more a robot than that chess playing machine.
You remember the guy in Turk. The movie Big, where you went up to him? He was on
Zoltar. Yeah,
the Midway. Yeah, Zoltar. It's she's a robot. No more like a robot Zoltar than Zoltar. A robot.
Yeah,
is it program it's responses. A player piano.
Yeah, it's a player. It's sad. Piano. Thank you. You know what else is sad? Less than 10% of Google account owners are using two-factor authentication.
I was just reading this. I'm using two-factor.
I'm using two-factor.
Two-factor all the way.
We're not in the majority. We're the best.
We're good people.
We're good people. Oh.
I explain this every week on the radio show, which, you know, I assume the radio show is where I talk to the most normal of people.
And, you have a radio show?
Yeah. You don't listen because you're not normal.
That's true.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty big deal, this radio show. It's on 200 stations across the country.
Oh, okay.
And it's it's a call-in technology show.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so I answer questions. But I try to bring the level of understanding that we all have and the level of the conversation we all have to people who aren't as obsessed with technology as we are. And I think I told my daughter.
Two-factor is hard to explain, though. Like, it sounds nerdy. But even after you explain it, it's kind of hard for people to understand how it works unless you show them. So, like, I'm never going to get my mom to do two-factor, ever.
My mom does two-factor. I just told her that it prevents the government from spying on your computer.
Liar!
Okay. And did that work?
That's the one thing it doesn't do.
My mom can barely use email, so getting her to use two-factor is a lost cause. But
I got my daughter to set it up. She called me in a panic the other day, saying Google says somebody's logged onto my account from New York City. It was an IPv6 address, so I think it was not probably anything bad. It wasn't a regular IP address. But I said, okay, well, a couple of things you should do immediately. One is change your Google password, and two, turn on two-factor. And she did it. Now, what I told her is she has an iPhone. Get the Google app on your iPhone, and when you go to this Google security page and you enable two-factor, say that you want a notification from the Google app as the factor. That doesn't – so there's no entry of numbers.
Right.
When you log in, Microsoft does this too. It's actually so much easier – when you log into your Google account, it says, okay, we're going to look at your phone and say yes if you approve this. That's as easy as you can get, right?
No, you're right.
It's and easier it's more than secure like than a text message.
Authenticator. I mean, or
it's easier than authenticator. Yeah.
Because at Fortune, we actually had to use...
Because of Bloomberg.
We had to use Authenticator.
Right? Or,
we did, yeah.
No, we had Bloomberg terminals, but I wasn't in the main office. I never used him.
But, and at Fortune, we had hard keys, right? We had the
We had hard keys. Yeah, the RSA hard keys.
RSA
for logging into the computer, and you had to change your password every 90 days.
That we, yeah. Which we now know is wrong.
I know. Dumb. I hated it.
Yeah, it was always a bad idea. So I think the real problem with two-factor, and the thing that's, I bet you more than 10% have tried it, is that some apps, particularly since we're in this app-driven world now because of the smartphone, don't understand two-factor. And right. So you have to create an application-specific password. And that is bad.
Yes. Which is a pain. Yeah.
Not only a pain, it's just crazy and it's confusing bad security. And it doesn't work. And so I think that's probably what happens is people go, yeah, this is, I'm not doing this anymore.
And I think a lot of people, like, it will take a significant negative event for them to sort of realize that this is important. So in the same way.
Well, that's what happened to my daughter. I think if that hadn't happened, there's no way I could have just said, oh, you should.
In the same way, my daughter lost her phone and she had not backed up any of her photos. So she lost all the photos of this European trip she went on.
Yep.
And so instantly she realized the value of backing up your phone. But it took till that moment. She was like, oh, yeah, I know you're supposed to, blah, 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 but I just never did. And then all of a sudden, it became much more important.
That's like renter's insurance. You never get it until something happens. Exactly. I mean, that's we're all stupid. Yeah, we're all lazy.
We're just dumb humans.
And I remember thinking I had my laptop stolen when I was in Italy. Someone grabbed my bag off the train. And I was glad then that I had two-factor on as many things as I did. All I did was log out of my Google account. And basically everything was inaccessible. And luckily I had my phone.
YouTube is asking for non-disparagement clauses from musicians. Mm-hmm. Before they'll promote your music, you have to say, we will never say anything bad about Google.
That seems like a lot.
Apparently that's not the norm in the music industry. Which
is it like you could trash your record label?
Apparently, you're allowed.
I guess Kelly Clarkson has.
Yeah, lots of musicians do. Yeah. Seems to be a pretty popular thing.
It's interesting.
I find it hard to believe they could enforce that. But
well, if you want the promotion, music and original series creators. I know you want to talk about this. Jeff Jarvis certainly would, but I know Matthew would like to talk about this. Crowdsourced ratings for news sources on Facebook, which has just struggled coming up with some sort of solution to the perceived crisis in fake news. And I say perceived because I don't necessarily even buy into this. Now is saying, well, we've decided what we're going to do is do surveys and ask people whether they trust news sources, kind of like Yelp for news sources.
Well, so what they say is that they're going to, and actually Adam Mosseri, who's in charge of the news feed, has been responding to a bunch of people on Twitter, including me, about this. And they haven't gotten into a huge amount of detail about how it's going to work. I know somebody, I'm trying to remember.
In BuzzFeed, the Alex Cantor has the survey.
Alex got the survey. Yeah. There's two questions.
Do you recognize the following websites, yes or no?
Right.
And how much do you trust each of them? Entirely, a lot, somewhat, barely, not at all.
So the most charitable interpretation of this survey is that they're going to use your answers to those two things along with the reams of data that they have about you and your behavior from all the time you spend on Facebook in order to come up with a trust ranking. So that it's not like that.
It's just another questions. Signal. Yeah.
Right. It's another signal. They're going to look at what you clicked on, how long you spent on it. They're going to look at how much you know about different things, how familiar you are with different things. But I think Adam did admit that this is a very nuanced question. Do you trust something? The problem is that I just finished writing about a big survey that Gallup and the Knight Foundation did about trust in media. And what they found was it's split along ideological lines. Lots of other research has found this too. So do you trust the media gets completely different answers depending on whether someone identifies as a Republican or a Democrat.
Right.
And so do you trust the New York Times is going to get a completely different response. So is do you trust Fox News? So the problem is they're going to have to, in order to get at the real problem, which is the website that, you know, creates itself last week and comes up with a real sounding name and posts a bunch of garbage. In order to get at that problem, they're going to have to find a way around the ideological kind of rift that exists when you ask people if they quote unquote trust the media.
It strikes me, though, that it would be really easy to pinpoint those completely fraudulent clickbait sites. Like, that's the easiest.
Theoretically.
That's the easiest thing
to do. Yes, theoretically.
I don't know.
The hard ones are the ones in between.
Right.
So they post something. This happens all the time. Craig Silverman at BuzzFeed has a PhD in this stuff, basically. They will post true things and then something completely fake. So it's not all completely fake. Or they'll post things that have a grain of truth, but they're completely distorted. So it's hard. It's not just 100% fake all the time.
It's like most good con men. They tell you the truth most of the time.
Exactly.
Really? Are you telling me the truth right now?
You'll never know.
But I mean, Facebook's, let's face it, they have a hard problem.
It's a hard thing to do, yeah.
And I think they don't really have the tools, or it's not in their DNA to kind of do this stuff. Their DNA is build things really quickly, roll them out, get people to engage on your platform, the end. So they're good at that. But what we're talking about and what Zuckerberg says he wants to do, which is to prioritize quality engagement and meaningful discussion over just sort of raw engagement, that's a really, really hard line to find.
I was going to say, there are people that I know who are huge Trump supporters who will spend lots of time talking and debating over truly fake stories. And they will be meaningfully engaged and exhibiting that sense of community. So
the last thing I wrote for CJR was about how I actually think their changes could make it worse. So if they're looking at, like you said, meaningful discussion, engagement, people spending lots of time, you know what's really engaging? Garbage. Like totally made up.
That's what the Pope says.
And the Pope is right.
The Pope says fake news.
I'm not
news.
Sure the devil came up with it. I think his sourcing might be a little questionable.
He says fake news goes back to the Garden of Eden.
Okay.
The church has announced that there will be a World Day of Social Communications this May. And so he was, I guess, talking about that. And actually, he's not too bad on this. He says fake news is effective because, like the snake in the Garden of Eden, it mimics real news and it captures people's attentions by exploiting emotions like anxiety, contempt, anger, and
frustration. Yeah, he's totally right about that.
He says social networks are the ideal delivery system. Untrue stories can spread so quickly that even authoritative denials fail to contain the damage. And that turns people, the absence of opposite viewpoints turns people into unwilling accomplices in spreading bias and baseless ideas. Of course, the Pope very famously endorsed Donald Trump during the election in what is often used as the definitive example of fake news. That was believed and spread and probably had some impact.
I will say, if we're talking about fake news, the big book, there's some fact-based sourcing issues there. I don't know that the Pope wants us to look too closely into, but he's got a point. He definitely has a point. I don't know about the snake part.
The snake thing might be fake, for all we know. Yeah.
The problem is that Facebook, you know, whether they say they do or not, if what they want is engagement, you know, things that make people mad and
They're optimized for fake news, aren't they?
They're effectively a machine for confirmation bias, and that feeds into that whole problem.
This probably goes right in the same bucket as Donald Trump's anti-Samsung tweet. Rupert Murdoch put out a statement saying that he wants Facebook and Google to pay him, and that's how you trusted publishers. It should pay those publishers a carriage fee similar to the model adopted by cable companies, and that would solve the fake news problem.
Because cable is what we want to look to as an example for how things really work well.
Wow.
The cable industry.
Wow. You figure he wrote this in the middle of the night, and he just gave it to somebody and said, here, put this up.
So, I mean, Facebook does pay content companies. It pays them a revenue share.
Oh, well,
yeah,
there you go.
Lots of companies have revenue shares.
Sure, yeah.
So it's not a carriage fee, but you could argue maybe they should pay more. I think Jonah Peretti said that he thought Facebook could pay more. They probably could. They certainly have boatloads of cash.
Money.
But structuring the internet like a cable, like the cable industry, is not, I think, the solution.
We'll actually be talking with this about this with an old friend, Andrew Keene, who's going to be on Triangulation in a couple of weeks. He says Mark Zuckerberg is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Oh, Andrew.
Andrew is, speaking of link bait, he's a master.
He sure is.
Of the well-turned, infuriating phrase. And I look forward to getting him on.
He's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. He's a hoot. Let's see. Facebook has invented a new unit of time.
Okay. This was reported like super snarky, but I mean, this is actually...
No, this is actually a technical...
Common
thing.
Yeah. Maybe not common in engineering, but like you definitely create a measurement that works to the problem you're trying to solve, sure, which is all they did.
Yeah.
But from a headline point of view, this is what you would have to call it.
It's called the flick or frame tick. It is one... I can't even read this number. 70,560,000,000. I don't know. It's one tiny bit of a second. And you know who I bet came up with this? Colleen. She works in streaming video at Facebook, our old engineer. I wouldn't be surprised at all if this has her.
I hope she trademarked it.
The flick. Yeah, and everybody snarked about it. I'm not snarking about it. It's for video. You need it. Down to 20 cities for Amazon, all the ones you expect, and Toronto.
Yay.
Yay.
And Austin.
Really? Austin in there too?
Yeah, we're the only non-East Coast.
Good old Austin.
Well, the reason they're all on the East Coast is because Amazon's already on the West Coast, right?
So, right.
Yes,
They need to kind of...
So they can be really hot or really cold.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Maybe they'll have They'll move the HQ based on the season. It'll be
Apple
of the sun HQ.
They could have two.
Apple says it's going to invest a significant, like $30 billion of the repatriated money it's going to get back from its overseas cash, building a second headquarters. And the rumor is in Reno, Nevada.
Really?
And the reason
Austin
is
actually their second largest. Reno?
There's a big Austin
employee.
Reno,
because, Austin
Reno because it'll be a help center.
That's what we had.
It's a good,
and there's lots of room,
expensive,
cheap real estate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And actually, that's why people were in Austin. Dell had the best. Man, Dell had the
that's
best
true.
Call center.
Yeah, it was. That's Austin. Right.
Yeah.
Well, Apple's call centers here. Nest supports here in Austin.
I thought call centers were all in Ireland now or something.
No, a lot of high value call centers are in Austin. Maybe high value is the wrong way to think of it. But we have a lot of that industry. And then what happens is, like, when Apple bought Intrinsity, they come and they find, oh, hey, there's a great chip design community and lots of educated people who don't want to move to California. So it's not a bad place to be, says the lady who's lived here for 20 years.
Former Twitter COO Anthony Noto.
Mm-hmm.
This story comes from before he announced his departure from Twitter, but I thought it was interesting. This was at CES. He says that streaming devices like Apple TV, Fire TV, and Chromecast are on the chopping block. In 5 years, they'll be gone. You'll just go from your phone to a TV.
I think he's right.
Of course.
I think he's right.
Of course that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my TV has Chromecast built in. I don't even use a Chromecast.
Right. And, of course, he's assuming that Twitter will be the source of a lot of that streaming.
Mm-hmm. But he won't be there anymore.
No, because right after that...
He left.
He's going to become the CEO of a financial startup called SoFi.
Which we may recognize from scandals such as... Oh, were they the don't have sex in the stairwells one? Actually,
Let's Google SoFi and stairwells. I don't know, you know? That sounds vaguely familiar. No, you're thinking of Zenefits.
Oh, Zenefits.
Don't confuse SoFi with Zenefits. SoFi is a financial business, refi kind of thing.
Yes, but they had a scandal. Yeah. Their scandal was it bad loans? Obviously.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Hold on.
No, there was. There was something. I think you're right.
It's definitely a problem in that industry.
Yep. He came from Goldman
Sachs. Twitter, though.
He came from Goldman Sachs to Twitter in 2014. Yeah. And was instrumental in the push for live video. He did the deal with NFL for the football games, and of course, Twitter's.
It's going to be interesting to see whether they like how things change strategically, because he did push that a lot, and in a lot of ways, he was the only full time senior employee. I mean, Jack is a sort of part time CEO at Square as well. So everybody always looked to Anthony as kind of the guy who actually ran things.
Oh, interesting.
That's going to leave a big hole. That's for sure. And Twitter has a lot of holes. Like, it doesn't need a big hole.
Huge turnover in the executive suite. Huge.
Yeah.
This is just one more to add to that list.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Stock's not really doing very well either.
4% down on Tuesday when this came out. But the stock's been kind of.
So they had the frat house atmosphere and bad underwriting. So I knew there was something happening.
Me too. Them too. I guess we have a new hashtag. Yeah. Them too. I love this article in The Verge. It's really not, completely about us, but Vlad Savov writing about headphones. Buying headphones in 2018 is going to be a fragmented mess, not the least because of Apple's iPhone 10 and Google's Pixel 2 abandoning the headphone jack.
All of this. Well, that and no headphone jack, so that's a problem. And then you've got all the USB-C lighting. Yeah. I don't even...
It's a mess.
I am so frustrated.
It's a mess. There's also now competing codecs. You've got aptX.
Yes.
LDAC. What? It's just... that's
so we're going backwards now.
It's a Tower of Babel.
Like, headphones used to be the one thing where you could kind of use it with everything.
It worked. The analog.
Any kind of
mini jack.
Yeah.
The worst thing you'd have to do is buy an adapter from a full size to a mini jack.
Here's where we need some regulation. We just need some standards for these things, darn it.
Well,
I don't actually want to regulate this, but I'm like, come on, people.
And the market doesn't help because, frankly, people buy into a single system. So if you're an iPhone user,
they do.
You know what your solution is. It's very specific. But it doesn't work on necessarily on
and everybody
Pixel
seems
2.
To be fine. Apple buyers seem to be fine with every year or two buying
something new.
$500 worth of new dongles so they can connect all their stuff.
I don't understand that at all. But now that I'm living it, I honestly think if I could find a decent phone, with a headphone jack, my next phone may
Samsung,
it's not for another
year. They're not a bad
But I'm not gonna buy a phone until the next year.
Rebel?
Rebel.
Is that a brand name?
I mean, Rebel. Fight back.
Oh.
No, fight back. Resist.
I'm like,
hashtag
what am I going to do? Not have a cell phone?
Yeah,
wow. That would be a big resistance.
Flip phone.
That
would be Flip phone.
They don't have headphone jacks either, I might point out.
Yeah.
Stripe, I don't know what took them so long, is ending support for Bitcoin payments on the Stripe platform. Just like everybody else, for the same reasons. It takes a long time for a transaction to clear, and it costs $20.
Yeah.
It's
Bitcoin,
not practical.
It's no longer what it set out to be. It's no longer convenient or useful or a good store of value or good for transactions.
And the volatility makes it really bad for buying stuff because you're paying $1 for $1,000. You don't know what
So I will say, though, that I recently did get a press release from the Aura Family Dentistry, which is the 11th dental practice accepting DentaCoin.
They have their own?
Call me
God,
when they
can
accept.
You imagine? We're complaining about fragmentation in headsets. Can you imagine fragmentation if every single industry gets its own currency?
What about Dogecoin? Do they accept Dogecoin?
Dogecoin gone back up. Father Robert has, a million Dogecoin? He's got some ungodly amount because it was a joke.
Wow.
It was a joke.
Yeah.
Actually, though, I think this Stripe thing is, it's clear the bubble's going to burst. This
for sure.
Too volatile, too unpredictable, too expensive.
Yeah.
It's not a good payment solution.
Well, I read a great...
go on.
You first.
I thought it was nice how he described it as an asset, not a currency, which was a very polite way of saying, this isn't liquid.
It's good for speculating.
Yeah. And I read a great essay, I can't remember who wrote it now, about how basically Bitcoin has become everything that Satoshi Nakamoto invented Bitcoin to sort of not be. Yeah. So it's become the opposite of what it was supposed to be in almost every way. Yeah,
it's not good. What about ICOs? We've not talked about it on the show because it's complicated. Initial coin offerings. And the big hook this week is Telegram, which is doing a massive ICO.
Keep getting bigger.
They're thinking now $2 billion. So the idea is that you buy, what do they call
them? Tokens.
Teletokens? Telecoin. You buy their cryptocurrency as an investment in Telegram. And then do ICOs, are they like stock? Do you get part ownership?
So that's the big question. That's the big question. And it's why the SEC kind of needs to make regulations in this area, or somebody does. Because the whole point of doing ICOs was that they weren't treated like equity. So because they theoretically had utility, and there's all kinds of arcane regulations around this. But if something has utility, if you can enjoy it or use it in and of itself, if it's not just a certificate that represents a share of a company, then it's not considered equity. So I think the classic case,
if you can pay your dentist with it,
or if you can use it for some other reason. So the classic case was baseball cards. So baseball cards, even though you can buy and sell them, they're not shares of a company and they're not currency, because you enjoy them having them, and you enjoy them for that. Share certificates, very few people enjoy them for the certificate. They like it and invest in it because it gives them a share of the profits of a company. So the idea was tokens were, because they had utility, they were not shares, not equity, but you could still raise a ton of dough with them. So the last thing I saw from the SEC was a release that basically said, like, everybody settle down. We're going to do something in this area. But there's, as far as I know, there's been no concrete moves to either regulate them or shut them down. And there's a debate about what utility represents. So some tokens give you effectively time or processing time on a Bitcoin mining
One of the reasons people are interested in the Telegram ICO is because these coins called grams, which won't be issued for another year, are intended to be used as a basis for transactions on Telegram.
Right.
For payments.
Right. And Kik was going to do the same thing. I don't know if they actually did one, but they were going to use it for transactions on their own platform.
Huge messaging platform. It was shut down in Iran because it was dominant in Iran. It was widely being used to help organize
protests. Then if you can use it for payments, it's not equity. So then it's not covered by the SEC.
So you'd be buying into a payment system.
It's a payment system.
Yeah.
It's a currency. Therefore, you have to go to the place that regulates currencies.
It's currency investment.
But Stacey's point is a good one. What if everybody has their own currency? Who the heck determines the exchange rate? Like, there's no central bank to tell you this coin is worth X or it's exchangeable for Y. Or
what gets really interesting is I've talked to some people doing like energy tokens based on basically smart metering. So there's like a group in Australia that's doing a very interesting thing with this. They did an ICO and they, you know, you bought into their token system, and that allowed you to buy and sell electricity, solar electricity generated by your neighbors at a lower cost, because it was a edge of the grid, and so you didn't pay the transmission costs from the real electricity provider, I guess. So what I thought was interesting, though, is what happens when you buy into that system and you're buying and selling your electricity using these tokens, which does have a value and it doesn't feel radically speculative. What happens when you want to leave that system? Like, you move.
It's illiquid. Yeah.
Right.
And so, that's always been the challenge, is
it has to be a challenge. Yeah. I mean, you have to, do you remember the early days of internet payments, and there was beans and flus and
oh my God, I think
one
yes.
of them, One of them, and, Whoopi Goldberg was involved in.
Canadian Tire Bucks.
Yeah, actually, they're still around. But they got a special dispensation, believe it or not, from the government to issue their own currency. But anyway, so I remember those days, everybody, well, I've got 50 beans or I've got 100 flus or whatever.
Flus,
and,
yeah.
And it quickly became nonsensical. But
if you,
I mean,
think about it, Apple Pay isn't really any different. Nominally, Apple Pay is dollars.
Right.
But the way Apple Pay, you know, the payment system and messages works is you don't cash out of it. you could cash out of it, but you just kind of keep it there. It's, in a way, it's its own currency. You know, it's
the thing is
it's guaranteed to be translated into dollars at some point.
So that's the thing. You need someone to basically guarantee that there will be value for you if you want to cash out and use the money to go buy a house or something. If you're just speculating, you probably don't care. But if you actually want to use it as a store of value or transactions, you need someone, some authority that will tell you that the value is going to be there when you need it.
Y'all are about to talk us down to the gold standard.
No. Yeah.
This is fiat money.
It's all fiat.
But the thing that fascinates me is that
one's a fiat banked by the full faith and currency of Satoshi Nakamoto, and one is or a bunch of miners in China, and the other is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, which is you know, that's a little more subsidiary.
Theoretically,
the U.S. could default.
These currencies remind me a lot more of currencies in small countries where the government changes rapidly and the army takes over periodically. Right. And the value of them literally changes day by day, month by month. There's always an underground currency that people actually use instead of the real currency. And people are carrying around wheelbarrows full of
millions.
Many of
these governments solve this by tying their money to the U.S. dollar.
Yeah. The fascinating thing for me is that cryptocurrencies effectively just reveal the sort of central fiction about money, which is that it has any value at all. I mean, we don't have like pieces of paper that we exchange with people that have colored pictures on them don't have any inherent value.
Right.
They have value because a bank somewhere said that it will accept them at such and such a value.
Well, some people are still backed. Aren't some countries still on some sort of gold standard?
But
they're not using that currency.
Feel that that's imaginary because the value of gold is not based on its true value. It's based on
its trading value.
Its trading value. Which
and if
is
you want to look at something that's a crazy market, gold was the original crazy market. Yeah. That stuff changes value for no reason whatsoever.
Right.
Like the actual underlying value of it is infinitesimal. The thing that interests me is I was on a panel about cryptocurrency a little while ago, and a guy from the Bank of Canada was there. And the Bank of Canada is the central bank. It regulates the entire banking industry. And he said that they were thinking of creating their own cryptocurrency.
So is the Bank of England.
Yeah.
And the Bank of Israel.
So now you've got a central bank effectively, but now they're competing with every other cryptocurrency.
But that's a currency. Really,
they're competing with their own currency.
Well, exactly. I think what they're saying, and I think this is actually really interesting, it's about blockchain. They want a transparent, fast, decentralized way of recording transactions, better than their current system.
Which you could argue is the real value. So cryptocurrency is fascinating.
I will totally argue that.
Bitcoin is, there's a lot of hype and it's fun to watch, but the real value is blockchain and that sort of distributed ledger approach to all kinds of information. Currency is just a tiny, tiny fraction of what blockchain could be applied to. That's what I find interesting.
So, Stacey, what is blockchain?
I'm glad he asked you.
Excellent. All right. It's just a distributed ledger. It's a technology that allows you to write information to and read information from many distributed nodes. I'm not going to get into super technical stuff.
Let me try it this way. A transaction. A value currency and money is all about value. So it's like a battery for value. You know, a battery takes electricity generated, stores it till you need it. In the earliest days before money, you would chop some wood for somebody and she'd give you a pie. And there was a direct thing. But now we got a problem. If I want to chop some wood, but I don't want pie, I want to get some shoes from over there. We have some way of storing value. Could be puka shells. It has been. Or cowrie shells. It has been. Could be strings, knots in a string. It could
large
be
rocks.
It could be anything, but you want somewhere to store that value in that everybody agrees that's worth an hour's worth of chopping wood. And then
so
you can exchange it around. The problem with this is that's easy to do when there's an actual physical thing that you exchange around. But in our modern world, it's impractical to exchange physical things. So it's all become bits. So now what you need is some way to record that Leo earned this many bits, that he's given this many bits to Stacy, that Stacy's given this many bits to Matthew, and you want some way to do that efficiently, securely, in a trustworthy way. Otherwise, you got a real problem. And that's the idea of blockchain is it's not – and no bank – normally now MasterCard does it or Visa does it or the Bank of Canada does it. And they keep the ledger and you trust they're going to do it right. But it's centralized. Yeah. What they would like is some way of recording this in a trusted fashion that everybody agreed on, but
that's
no one – that's completely decentralized. Right. No one
and
is
– that was the key – that for me was the key – the key thing that Satoshi Nakamoto wanted to do. It wasn't just the mining and the crypto and so on. It was the distributed and non-centralized nature of it. Right. So that in effect, everyone who does a transaction is a bank and is a transaction processor and has a copy of the ledger and can read and write the ledger.
Oops. Let me give you a story that I wrote about this all the way back in 2015 about why blockchain matters. And basically, it's because we need something that is, yes, like Matthew said, that is not necessarily secure because there's actually issues about that, but something you can authenticate and that is scalable. And that's the key. You need it to be scalable. And for scalability, it needs to be decentralized. And that's why it matters. And I talk to companies who are doing blockchain-based security for IoT. I talk to micropayment people. They're very fascinating. And so once you take it outside of cryptocurrencies, which are interesting, but are really a sideshow for figuring out how to use blockchain for things that will actually be world-changing. So I don't know what to say about that. And there's different variations.
I think you could argue the sideshow, the financial sideshow, is actually one of the ways that people are trying to generate money to do the other things that are interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's to invest in.
I wrote about a distributed computing platform that basically you can link all your computer, like any computing element in your connected home, for example, you could link to solve edge problems at the edge. So machine learning type problems at the edge. So think of it like SETI on your Nest. Mm-hmm. So they're using a blockchain technology, but they're also thinking about doing an ICO because it's an easy way for them to raise money now.
Yeah.
And then they'll use their currency as a way to trade value among that system. I feel like the currency is kind of a side. You don't need a token, but they're using it as a way to make money. And I think that's going to cause a lot of problems, kind of like back in the 2000s when we had all those crazy .coms.
Yeah.
There was actually a lot of value created then.
And that's what I was saying.
Infrastructure
to Leo,
value.
It reminds me of the early internet. There were so many dumb things, and everybody just took whatever they did and added the word internet to it, or had a website. In the same way, Long Island Iced Tea changed its name to Long Island Blockchain, so that everyone's just adding that to kind of get on the bandwagon. But underneath, there is something real, just like there was in the early days of the internet. It's just gonna take some time to get rid of the froth, you know, and to see what the actual real applications are. There's a journalism startup called Civil. They're going to do an ICO. They want to use blockchain and the sort of distributed ledger as a tool for distributing and paying for independent journalism. That's an interesting idea.
So,
and there's different types of blockchain implementations. So that's something worth noting. There's like Bitcoin, Ethereum, everything's done in public. A lot of private companies said, I don't want my data in public. I want it private. IBM created Hyperledger. There's new variations where there's the so-called blockless blockchains that, you know, aren't as slow and heavy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a problem with the way Bitcoin and Ethereum do it, because you get these massive ledgers that everybody has to store.
So that's not a problem, though, if you think about it, is trying to create a currency with some sort of stored value. The stored value, though, wasn't an hour of chopping wood. It was an hour of GPU time, for example.
Right.
So,
although there is an issue on resource use with Bitcoin, someone said to generate a single Bitcoin takes, you know, as much power as
about it as an economic unit, though. So people, you know, chopping wood, you know, take energy. They require calories in. What we've done is we've transferred all of our work, as it were, to a digital. Now the work is not us. We are not the productive entities. And that's a huge sea change if we think that's actually going to happen.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it really doesn't matter where the work comes from, what the work is, as long as we all agree on the value and the units and so forth.
So that's the hard part.
Yes.
But is that really valuable? And I don't think we're there yet, because if all we did all day was trade Bitcoins or blockchain or Ethereums or whatever.
Well, but the market determines what real world value, you know, are those 10,000 Bitcoins worth two pizzas? Or are they worth two houses? The market, this is the problem. This is why it's really volatile right now. But at some point, you'd think the market would settle on a value.
Well, there's dozens of different markets. That's the problem.
Yeah. So
it's not just Bitcoin. Problem. There's like 20 different, you know, cryptocurrencies that are all going up and down in value because people are arbitraging them. And whenever there's money involved, there will be people who want to steal the money, and there will be people who want to arbitrage the value between one and the other.
And so think of this as all a out-of-town tryouts for some system that is ultimately going to replace our current financial system. We're learning right now what works, what doesn't work. Well, yeah, you don't want a 200-gigabyte ledger. Exactly. That's not going to work.
It may not just replace the financial system, though. It might also replace credentialing or identity. There's all sorts of interesting applications beyond financial systems. So don't just limit yourself. There's,
of course,
medical and government.
Authentication, right? Is that the fundamental problem? Authentication and validation of transactions?
It's one of the problems, for sure.
It's one of the problems. You can't think of this like as a binary.
So,
they are not as secure as they should be.
Okay.
Well, so
I think something like 10% of all the value, all the ICO value, I think someone said 10% of all the ICO value that's been created to date was stolen.
I think it was 20%.
Was it 20%? It was a big number anyway.
I feel like even something so...
No, it's more than 20%. It's a huge
Instead of thinking about value, think about just tracking something. So understanding where something's been. And that's how, like, oh God, who's using the blockchain to track turkeys? Tyson, Purdue? I think it's Purdue. But those are the kind of things that become... They're not doing it in a... Yes, it's a little bit of like, but they're actually tracking it for foodborne illness purposes. So there are really interesting things that will come of this. And I don't know how much of it actually will be money, because we have a decent monetary system. I think we're going to have to eliminate some fees, and it's going to have to become a little bit faster, and blockchain would allow some of that.
And I think there are, you know, we should admit there are some kind of creepy aspects to a ledger, a single ledger that keeps track of all your transactions, however small, that you engage in as you move around the internet. Lots of things could be done by tracking.
Well, not just you, but your car, your dishwasher.
Your car, all your smart devices, everything you touch. You know, there's lots of ways that information could go wrong as well.
Know my turkey ended up at my house, for example.
would make me happy. That would make me happy.
The idea is that the CDC would say, oh, Stacy just reported that she's, you know, got salmonella.
17 to 23% of all the Bitcoin is missing.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, Satoshi Nakamoto has like a million.
He's got
Bitcoins,
tons of Bitcoin.
Yeah. Wherever he is.
Whoever or whatever. Or, I mean, at this point, you have to think he might not be alive, or he hasn't moved any of them.
It seems unlikely that he's still alive, but but I'm much more interested in the sort of other, like Ethereum interests me a lot more than Bitcoin because there's a lot more you can do with it. ICOs, for example, I think were something that Ethereum came up with. The whole idea of having tokens that have value on the network that can then be exchanged is a kind of, it's a second order value, whereas Bitcoin's, it's just, hey, you have a Bitcoin, the end.
Right.
You know, to see kind of how value can be generated within that network brings, like, opens up a lot more possibilities for other things.
I have avoided bringing this up. I'm glad I brought it up with you two. I think that was, this has been very educational. Thank you.
It's a
Matthew
fascinating
used to be
area,
a securities reporter.
There you go.
It's true.
As did I. Oh, so
I brought it up with the right two people. Jeff would have been snoring by now, so it's okay.
We'd still be talking about Davos.
We would be. We would be. Let's take a break and we can get some picks from you folks right after this. A word from our sponsor, WordPress. You talk about success. WordPress runs 29% of the web, the whole world. Almost a third of all the web pages in the world are running on WordPress. Big publications, small blogs, my small little blog. WordPress is a global force, and it's a great place to create your next website, whether it's a blog, a business site, or both. WordPress.com is the place to go. I, for a long time, ran a self-hosted WordPress. That means I had my own server, downloaded the code, had to keep it up to date, had to keep it secure. That turned out to be a lot of work. Once I moved to WordPress.com, all my troubles went away. It's the same WordPress platform. I understood it. All those great tools that are out there, all the people who know how to do WordPress, you get advantage of this just massive community. But they do the hosting, they do the security, they do everything, and it's more affordable than running your own server, and it's better. WordPress.com is a community. They can even drive traffic to your site because it's actually a social network. There's a front page, WordPress.com. You could put a follow button on your site. People could follow you, generate more traffic. WordPress is really all about you engaging with your audience and your audience supporting you by sharing. You get automatic social sharing. So if you write something great, they'll show it. They can easily share it to their Twitter, their Facebook, their Pinterest, their Instagram, all of that. You get built-in search engine optimization, so you're easier to find. All the technical stuff's handled. You don't need experience. You don't even need to hire somebody. They can guide you through the entire process from start to finish. And look, a personal site on WordPress is low as $4 a year. They even have a free tier and a great customer support team. WordPress
experts. I use WordPress.
Yeah, who doesn't?
Me too.
Yep, see? 100% of us use WordPress. Leolaporte.com. WordPress.com/twig. If you go there right now, you can save 15% on your new plan purchase. WordPress.com/twig. The experts at WordPress are there to help you 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday, on weekends too. It could not be easier, but do go to WordPress.com/twig so they know you heard about it here. We're all big WordPress fans. I am a huge WordPress fan. I've been using it practically since Matt Mullenweg wrote it, and it gets better every day.
Me too.
Yeah, Matt's a great guy. WordPress.com/twig. 29% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress. 100% of our websites. Find out how to get yours running and save 15% at WordPress.com/twig. WordPress.com/twig. Matthew, you got a pick, a tip, something you want to share with us, something you're excited about?
I came across something I thought was funny. This isn't really a tip or anything useful or anything like that, but I
who
thought
said
it was
useful?
Interesting.
No one said useful.
This is totally not useful. It's useless. But I saw something. It's behind a paywall, but the Wall Street Journal had a story about how the internet was filling up because a lot of Indians are sending millions of texts that just say good morning. So I did a bit of reading about that and it's just a funny story. There's so many people, and most of what they're doing, they just got phones, and so the first thing they want to do is send a cheery greeting to everyone they know. And, you know, you multiply that by hundreds of millions of people, that's a lot of messages. So,
and there
they've
is
noticed networks slowing down. I just think it's funny that people are saying good morning.
It's the cutest thing ever in the Wall Street Journal article.
They have some images. Good morning to my life's rose. Your fragrance makes all of life's thorns worth tolerating. They talk about this fella, Dishraj Sharma. He's 71 years old. He likes to send good morning messages on his phone. He wakes up and sends them to 51 friends and family on WhatsApp. Yeah. But there is a Google tie-in because Google's Files Go application has been modified. You know, it's the application you put on your Android phone that goes through your phone and clears up old files, unused apps, things like that. Modified to delete good morning messages.
I just thought, you know, if you're going to have a reason why your network is slow or your bandwidth is slowing down and you're running out of data, I think sending people good morning, too many good morning messages thing. Is a great reason.
Not a bad thing. They interviewed, the journal interviewed Josh Woodward, the Google project manager in Mountain View, who led the effort. We were trying to deconstruct what is the DNA of a good morning message. For months, he said, it's been a lot of hard work to get it right. Early versions were picking out photos of children wearing T-shirts with words on them. They unveiled the app last month in New Delhi. The morning message deletion function prompted the crowd of media and government officials to break out in applause.
Yeah. It's cleared up on average more than a gigabyte of data per user.
I think this is an awesome reminder that the world is an awesome place. It's like a unique place, and localization still matters.
I thought it was great.
Prime Minister Modi sends out good morning messages. Here's a guy who's a morning message maniac who sends. He spends 45 minutes every morning sending
and responding.
Yeah, the
images are important. They're like inspirational, you know. So I think Google said there'd been a tenfold increase in the number of Google searches for good morning images.
Well, and this guy, Kanwajat Singh, created just for this audience, wishgoodmorning.com, where you can get your good morning. So if you want to join the good morning craze, here's one for your mom. I love you, Mom. Good morning. Good morning, dear mom. Dear mom, our house is a home only because of you. I love you. Good morning.
Isn't that great?
My daughter would be so into these.
I think
she would send
these.
This is
the sweetest thing ever.
Like if your phone crashes, it's not fun, or you use up all your internet data. But I think it's a pretty good reason.
You could take care of this by just deleting the message after you get it.
So that's why there's an app.
Yeah. I am going to start sending. Don't be surprised. If you all start getting good morning messages from me. Stacy, you got a pick for us?
I have a tip. Your audience probably knows about it, but I figured they may not, and it's worth sharing. Okay, so what was it? Oh, yeah, Netflix voice match. I'm like, what was it? I don't even remember. For Google Home. So basically, you know how you can match your voice to Google and that works for some people. It doesn't work for my daughter and I, but that's okay. Amazon's voice match doesn't work between my husband and I, so Google's a little better.
So you two sound a lot alike.
I don't think we do, because she is a child and her voice is that of a child. But that's okay. Right. And I don't particularly have a childish voice, I don't think.
No.
You have a deep, rich adult voice.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's puzzling to me, but I'm okay with it.
Does she sound like this? She said, good morning. Hello, Echo.
She doesn't, but she sounds like a kid. I don't know. It's very different. So you can tell when you tell Hey G, fire up next Netflix, which is my shortcut for firing up Netflix.
Hey G, nice.
No, I'm just not triggering.
Oh, okay, you're not saying.
I'm trying to be respectful.
I got you.
So Hey G, fire up Netflix. It now knows that I have asked for it, and it will go to my profile. So it will not show me, you know, all the crazy stuff that... Actually, it won't show me Narcos and all of the other stuff that my husband watches that I'm kind of deemed too violent and scary. He's got a thing for those Mexican drug lords.
So does my wife. They should meet each other. She reads every book. She is so into this.
We have like all the Pablo Escobar. We have all the newer ones. Okay. We have them all.
All right.
Yep.
Yeah. So that I thought was kind of a nice tip. So to find it and to do it, you go into your Google Home apps. You have to go under the more settings or under the settings thing. You have to go under more And then you should be able to link your Netflix account. So you also have to link your Netflix account. And then poof, there it is.
Karsten just sent me a good morning message.
Nice. Oh,
Karsten.
Good morning, Karsten, boss.
That's so sweet.
This is so suck up. You are a good boss, but most importantly, you are a greatest human being.
Nice.
Not the greatest, just a greatest.
One of the greatest. Well, tying into yours, you know, today, we've been waiting for it, Google Play Books added audiobooks.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it happened. I'm looking at mine now. Enjoy ebooks,
that's
audiobooks,
pretty handy, actually.
Comics, and more. So, you know, it's not our favorite bookstore, Audible, our sponsor, but they have a lot of books. I presume they have probably all the books. The only thing they would lack is the Audible originals. Audible records a lot of stuff. And you can ask, and this was always something I preferred Echo because of. I could say, Echo, read my book, but now I can do it with Google Play if I buy the book on Google Play Books.
Dun, dun, dun.
Now I have this problem.
Fragmented audiobooks.
I have fragmented audiobooks. I don't know where my library lives. Oy.
Audible do a Google, it's not a skill, recipe,
no.
Something?
Leo, I was going to mention, remember you asked about Canada and net neutrality?
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically the bottom line is in a big part of the debate in the U.S. is whether internet providers should be considered common carriers. So in Canada, that is not a debate. They've been considered basically utilities under the Telecom Act.
So that's important. That's
from
huge.
The beginning. Yeah. So yeah, so there's been no debate about that. And also the CRTC is a lot less politicized than the FCC. So there isn't as much kind of back and forth about, you know, does the FCC chairman want it to be this way or that way? And who's lobbying who? And it's just a lot more boring, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, we like a good fight here in the United States.
But it also means that we've had things like data caps forever,
right,
as far as I can remember.
Well, and I know both Rogers and Telus mess with Skype because I experienced directly.
Yeah, and they do what they call bandwidth shaping, which is one of my favorite terms,
yep.
Which is basically throttling. And they've had repeated arguments with the CRTC about whether they should be able to do that or not. So it's not that we don't have issues. It's that regulatory wise, there isn't as much debate about how to handle it or what applies.
Right. Well, and the big bandwidth shaping, hardware that Comcast and others use comes from Canada. I can't remember the name of it.
Sandvine.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We used to have another one that was based in Michigan, but I can't remember that one. But yeah, Sandvine's there. Didn't they get bought? Let's see.
They did, I think.
Traffic Management Solutions.
Traffic Management.
Take control to sustain growth, manage costs, and preserve quality.
And get rid of those torrenting teenagers on your network.
BitTorrent losers off your network.
Huh. They got bought by a Canadian networking company.
Well,
PNI Canada, Acquia, something. It's a, looks like a shell thing. Hmm. Francisco Partners. I see it now. So
see, you can
this
watch
last year.
The reporter at work. She's stitching it together.
Sorry. Well, I'm just like, so it's a acquisition holding company that's an affiliate of Francisco Partners. So it's a PE deal. Yeah.
I have to say, having now seen the post, have you seen it yet?
No.
No.
Don't give it away.
Oh,
what happens? Don't tell me what happens.
I won't. It's a surprise. You won't believe. It is better than I thought. And
really?
If you're a journalist, obviously you are, you must see it because it is Steven Spielberg's ode to journalism. It's fantastic.
And Meryl is pretty good.
Well, it's the only thing that's a little strange. It's, you know, it's all these stars in it. I mean, it's just like even the bit parts are stars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Early on, Ben Bradley, played by Tom Hanks, is meeting with Catherine Graham, played by Meryl Streep. They're having breakfast. It's one of the first scenes. And you look at it and you can tell they're thinking, that's Meryl Streep. I'm Tom Hanks.
They'd never acted before, apparently, together.
You can tell. Well, this must have been the first scene they did together because the vibe is totally like,
nice.
We're we're Oscar winners.
Yeah.
And they're acting. They're like almost like trying to out-act each other. They're like, he's doing some voice and she's doing something. And it's, yeah. And it was actually sweet. It was cute. And it's at the early in the movie and you let it go after that. Cause
I do find it bothers me a little bit that the New York Times was the one that actually published the Pentagon.
Well, they say that. No, they say that. No, when you see the movie, you will actually see the whole story unfold.
They definitely say that.
And Ben Bradley is furious.
And it was more interesting with Catherine Graham because she had, you know, she was a woman and she had just taken over this paper.
They do
and it
all
was
of
whole
that.
Family's legacy.
All
yeah,
of
so
that's in
made
there.
It, I think a more interesting story.
All of that's in there. Even the classic 1940s trope of the presses pushing the button, the presses start nice. Rolling. You watch nice. The paper going, they throw it on the truck. The trucks go zooming out of the garage. Nice. They throw it off the truck and the paper boys pick it up. That's all in there.
And you see the front page.
Yep. Yeah. It practically spin it at you. I mean, it's amazing.
I have a button, a red and green button that I took from the presses at the Globe and Mail when I worked there.
Oh, they got rid of this.
They got rid of the old presses and they farmed it out to someone else and they took the presses out and you could keep bits of them if you wanted to. So I have the stop the presses button.
There are loving shots, the most beautiful shots ever of the lead,
the
typesetters.
Yeah. It's amazing.
It is an ode to journalism. It is Steven Spielberg's, like, I'm telling you, both of you, if you are not crying in this movie, you are dead inside.
Someday I want to get my own like hot type
yes.
setting machine and just print like a
thing.
Newspaper for kids, yeah. you know, or something.
And it must look it so anachronistic so to the younger generation, but those of us who remember are going, oh yeah. Like you can practically smell
yeah, the newsprint.
The newsprint. And then, Jeff Jarvis was talking about this. When the presses start,
yeah.
the coffee cup starts
the whole building, yeah. I remember that at the Globe.
It's awesome. So don't go tonight. And your husband will love it. Andrew will love it. Go tonight and see it.
Okay.
Because it will,
I'm
first
go
of all,
right now.
It will be the best picture of the year. There are great pictures.
You think?
Yeah. It's a Spielberg.
You think so?
They're great. It's got a lot of competition.
It's a tough year.
It's a tough year, but
Lady Bird was pretty good.
Lady Bird's great.
Three Billboards was pretty good.
This is not better than them, but this is a movie whose time has come. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
It is to save.
I think Shape of Water might get it.
Maybe.
Have you seen it?
No, there's good stuff. I know.
It's good.
I have a lot of movies to see.
It's good.
I'm glad I saw The Post, and I think it'll win because it's a statement about the importance.
Stacey, any bets?
Importance of a free press. In this
I
country,
so.
It's what it's all about. She's crying
yeah,
already.
It's a good time.
She's already crying. The
Uh-oh.
Water monster romance is not going to win.
No.
No. Free press.
Good movie.
God bless the free press in this country. This is the antidote to fake news. You will feel so good. You walk out of the door saying, yes. Stacey has cut her mic off so we can't hear her sobbing.
Yeah, sure.
All right, we're done. She wants dinner.
Okay.
She's had Cap'n Crunch, but it's been hours now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot my mic was off. My dog started barking.
We heard nothing.
Okay.
Do you have any Oscar bets?
You missed my good Get Out joke.
Get Out deserves to win. I agree.
You think so?
It's a great movie.
I haven't seen it.
Good.
What?
Good. You will be shocked.
That's the only movie I have seen.
You can rent that.
That's afraid it was going to be gory. It's not gory, is it?
It's gory.
It's not bad gory. Comedy gore.
Okay.
There's gore. I won't lie to you, Matthew.
There is gore.
Okay.
There will be gore.
But it's funny.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's funny, terrifying, depressing, exciting, exalting all at the same time, but it ends on a big laugh.
Okay.
So that makes it all better.
Okay. I have to leave now.
Goodbye, Stacey. Okay.
Thank you for joining us. I'm starving.
Stacey on IoT. Fun. I know. I can tell. You're faint. She's fainting.
I'm like, I'm starving. I have to go to the bathroom and they're cooking downstairs so I can hear.
Run,
I can smell it.
Run, Stacey. Run.
Captain Crunch.
Stacey on IoT.com. At Giga Stacey on the Twitter. Thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Stacey, always a pleasure.
Say goodbye to your erstwhile colleague, Mr. Matthew Ingram at the Columbia Review of Journalism, CJR. And MatthewIngram.com/work to read more about where he is. Thank you so much for being here. Jeff Jarvis was in Davos. He'll be back next weekend. So will we every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC for This Week in Google. We would love it if you'd watch live at twit.tv/live. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. But of course, you can always watch on demand at twit.tv/twig or subscribe. Please subscribe. That way we know you're watching every episode or listening. You get your choice. And we are doing our yearly survey. We'd love it if you would help us out by going to twit.tv/survey. It's only a few minutes this year. It's a few questions. We do this once a year to get to know you better, both for our own benefit, to help make better programming for you, but also so when advertisers ask us, does anybody ever listen to these shows? We can say, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We could tell you a little bit. We don't spy on you in any other way. We ask you just once a year to take a SurveyMonkey survey, but it's very helpful to us and to monetizing and making better programming. So please, if you would, twit.tv/survey. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.